was one part forethought, steeped in a thousand parts hasty action. And he was never happier than when he was testing the strength of a foe by offering it his skull for crushing. The 10 arms of the Barovada spread in an instant, and the two opponents grappled only briefly before Brangar was hurled 20 feet backwards, narrowly missing Gudrun. He landed very loudly. Micah moved to the attack then, with short curved blades, and I swallowed my misgivings and backed them with my own daggers. Sparks flew from every touch of Micah's knives against the thing's skin, and the air was filled with a mad whirl of obsidian arms and dodging thieves. Micah were faster than I, so I let them stay closer and keep the thing's attention. I lunged at it from behind, again and again, until one of the arms slapped me so hard I saw constellations of stars dancing across my vision. I stumbled away with more speed than grace, and a moment later Micah broke off the fight as well, vaulting clear. Past them charged Brangar, shouting something brave and unintelligible. A few seconds later, he was flying across the chamber again. Gudrun took over then, chanting and waving her hands. She threw vials and wooden tubes at the Barovada, and green fire erupted on its arms and head. Then came a series of silver flashes and a great ear-stinging boom, and the thing vanished in an eruption of smoke and force that cracked the stones beneath its feet and sent chips of rock singing through the air, cutting my face. Coughing, wincing, I peered into the smoke and was gravely disappointed, though perhaps not surprised, to see the thing still standing there, quite unaltered. Gudrun swore. Then Brangar found his feet again and ran headlong into the smoke. There was a ringing metallic thump. He exited the haze on his customary trajectory.
I believe we might take this thing at its word that we can do nothing against it while its substance is black, said Micah. How do we turn its skin silver?
Perhaps we could splash it with quicksilver, said Gudrun. If we only had some. Or coat it with hot running iron and polish it to a gleam, given a suitable furnace, 5 blacksmiths, and most of a day to work.
I packed none of those things, muttered Micah.
Little intelligent discourse took place for the next few minutes, as the invulnerable statue chased us in turns around the chamber, occasionally enduring some fresh fire or explosion conjured by Gudrun without missing a step. She also tried to infuse it with the silvery light by which we had made our way up the darker parts of the mountain. But the substance of the Barovada drank even this spell without effect. Soon we were all scorched and cut and thinking of simpler times, when all we'd had to worry about was burning to death in dancing fires.
Krail, lend me your sling, shouted Micah,
who were badly beset and attempting not to plunge into a trough of lava as they skipped and scurried from 10 clutching hands. I made a competent handoff of the weapon and a nestled stone, and was neither swatted nor burned for my trouble. Micah found just enough space to wind up and let fly, not at the Barovada, but at the ceiling. The stone hit one of the panes of black glass with a flat crack, but either it was too strong to break, or Micah's angle of attack was not to their advantage. I admit that I didn't grasp Micah's intent, but Gudrun redressed my deficiency.
I see what you're on about, she shouted. Guard yourselves!
She gave us no time to speculate on her meaning. She readied another one of her alarming magical gimmicks and hurled it at the ceiling, where it burst in fire and smoke.
The blast shattered not only the glass pane Micah had aimed for, but all those near it, so that it rained sharp fragments everywhere. I tucked in my head and legs and did a creditable impersonation of a turtle. When the tinkling and shattering came to an end, I glanced up and saw that the sundering of the blackened windows had let in diffuse shafts of cold light, swirling with smoke. Micah had been right. We were indeed close to open sky, and in the hours we had spent making our way through the heart of the anvil, the moons had also risen, shedding the red reflection of sunset in favour of silvery white lustre. This light fell on the statue, and Brangar wasted no time in testing its effect. Now when he tackled the Barovada, it yielded like an opponent of ordinary flesh. The king's strength bore it to the stones, and though it flailed for leverage with its vast collection of hands, Brangar struck its head thrice with his joined fists, blows that made me wince in overgenerous sympathy with our foe. Imagine a noise like an anvil repeatedly dropped on a side of beef. When these had sufficiently dampened the thing's resistance, Brangar heaved it onto his shoulders, then flung it into the nearest fountain of molten rock, where it flamed and thrashed, and quickly sank from our sight.
"I shall have to look elsewhere for a suitable watch upon my crypt."
Brangar retrieved the wrapped spear he had once more refused to employ, and wiped away smears of blood from several cuts on his neck and forehead.
"Presuming I am fated to fill one."
The small door swung open for us as we approached, and we were all so battle-drunk and blasted that we made a great show of returning the courtesy with bows and salutes. The room beyond was equal in length to the chamber of the Barovada, but it was all one great staircase rising gently to a portal that was notable for its simplicity. This was no door, but merely a passage in stone, and through it we could see more moonlight and stars. The chamber was bitterly cold, and drifting in flurries across the stairs were clouds of scattered snow that came from and passed into thin air.
"Hold a moment," said Gudrun,
kneeling to examine a plaque set into the floor. I peered over her shoulder and saw more Kandric script. "Here and last cross the serpent-touched snow, in each flake the sting of many asps. To touch skin once brings life's unmaking."
"To be stymied by snow in the heart of a fire mountain," I said, shuddering at the thought of death from something as small as a grain of salt brushing naked skin. "That would be a poor end." "We won't be trying it on for fit," said Gudrun.
She gestured, and with a flash of silver light, attempted the same trick I'd seen in Underwing Hall, to move herself in the blink of an eye from one place to another. This time, the spell went awry. With an answering flash of light, she rebounded from some unseen barrier just before the stairs, and wound up on her back, coughing up pale wisps of steam.
"It seems we're meant to do this on foot, or not at all," she groaned. "Here's a second ploy, then. If the snow is mortal to this flesh, I'll sing myself another."
She made a low rumbling sound in her throat and gulped air with ominous croaks, and with each gulp, her skin darkened and her face elongated, stretching until it assumed the wedge shape of a viper's head. Her eyes grew, turning greenish gold while the pupils narrowed to dark vertical crescents. In a moment, the transformation was complete. She flicked a narrow tongue past scaled lips and smiled.
"Serpent skin and serpent flesh towards serpent bite," she hissed. "And if it fails, I shall look very silly, and we can laugh long in the fields of swords and roses.
In the fields of swords and roses,
intoned Micah and Brandgar. But there would be no laughing there, at least not on this account, for wearing the flesh of a lizard, Gudrun hopped up the stairs. Clawed green hands held out for balance through 20 paces of instant death until she stood beside the doorway to the night, unharmed. She gave an exaggerated curtsy.
And can you do the same for us?
Shouted Micah.
The changing gift is in the heart of the wizard,
she replied.
Else I would have turned you all into toads some time ago and carried you in my pack, loosing you only for good behavior.
Micah sighed and pulled on their gloves. They studied the waft and weft of the snow for some time, nodding and flexing their hips.
Micah,
I said, kenning their intentions.
This seems a bit much, even for one of your slipperiness.
We've each come here with all the skills of lives long lived, they said.
This is the test of those lives and skills, my friend.
Micah went up the steps, fully clothed, but still their face and neck and wrists were unprotected. I understand it must be hard to credit, but that is only because you never saw Micah move, and any attempt to describe it with words must be a poor telling, even mine. Swaying and weaving, whirling at a speed that made them seem half ghost, they simply dodged between the falling snowflakes, as you or I might step between other people walking slowly along a road. In less time than it takes for me to speak of it, they had ascended the deadly 20 paces and stood safe beside Gudrun. They stretched idly, in the manner of a cat, pretending it has always been at rest, and that no mad leap or scramble has just taken place.
Well done, said Brangar. This is embarrassing, Krail. Those two have raised the stakes, and I am not sure how to make a show to match theirs, let alone surpass it.
My concerns are more prosaic, I said. I have no powers or skills I can think of to get myself out of this room.
We would be poor friends to leave you here at the threshold, said Brangar. And I fear it would disappoint our host. I have a notion to bear us both across. Can you trust me, as I have trusted you, absolutely and without objection?
You needn't use my affections as a lever, Brangar, said I.
Though truthfully, in the face of the serpent-touched snow, he rather did.
Anyway, I am famous among my friends for having never in my life behaved with any particular wisdom.
Be sure to make yourself small in my arms. Ho, Micah!
Brangar threw his wrapped spear up and over the snow, and Micah caught it. Without taking any further measures to brace my resolve, Brangar unclasped his cloak. Then he seized me, crushing me to his chest, as if I were an errant child about to be borne away for punishment. Apprehending his intentions, I clung to him with my legs, tucked my head against his armored coat, and once again commended my spirit to whichever celestial power was on guard over the souls of fools that night. Brangar spun his cloak over the pair of us like a tent, covering our arms and heads, blotting out my vision as well as his. Then, shouting some Azure battle blather that was lost on me, he charged blindly up the steps. My world became a shuddering darkness, and I vow that I could hear the hiss and sizzle of the venomous snow as it met the cloak, as though it were angry at not being able to reach us. Then we bowled over Gudrun and Micah, and wound up tangled in a heap, cloak and spear and laughing adventurers, safe and entirely bereft of dignity at the top of the steps.
Save for a lingering smell in our clothes and gear, the power of the snow seemed to promptly evaporate outside the grasp of the sorcerer's flurries. We were all gloriously alive. The light of moon and stars drew us on. Finally, what awaited us at the top of the Dragon's Anvil? Atop the mountain lay a caldera, a flat-bottomed cauldron of rock, wider than a longbow shot, and the stars were such brilliant figures of fire overhead that we could have seen well by them had it been necessary. But it was not, for here was the treasure of the dragon Glimrauk, and the dragon was clearly much taken with the sight. Arched pavilions of wood and stone ringed the caldera, each multiply tiered and grand as any temple ever set by human hands. 1,000 glass lanterns of the subtlest beauty had been hung from the beams and gables of these structures, shedding warm gold and silver light that scintillated on piles of riches too vast to comprehend, even as we stood there, gaping at them. Here were copper coins in drifts 20 feet high, and silver spilling like the waters of an undammed river. Gold nuggets, gold bars, gold discs, gold dust in ivory inset barrels. Here were the stolen coins of 10 centuries, plunder from Sendaria, the Crescent Cities, Far Olan, and the Sunken Lands. Here were the cold dead faces of monarchs unknown to us, the mottoes stamped in languages we couldn't guess, 1,000 currencies moulded as circles, squares, octagons, and far less practical shapes. There were caskets beyond counting, rich varnished woodcrafts that were treasures in themselves, and each held overflowing piles of pearls, amethysts, citrines, emeralds, diamonds, and sapphires. To account it all in meanest summary would double the length of my telling. Here were gilded thrones and icon tables, gleaming statues of all the gods from all the times and places the human race has set foot, crowns and chalices and toques and periaps and rings. Here were weapons crusted with gems or gleaming enchantments. Here were bolts of silk and ceramic jars as tall as myself, full of gourds and baubles, drinking horns and precious mechanisms. All the mountaintop was awash in treasure, tides of it, hillocks of it, the size of houses. There was nothing pithy to say. Even getting it down would become the work of years, I calculated. Years, and hundreds or thousands of people, and engineers and machinery and ships, if we could indeed force the dragon to part with this grand achievement. Helfalkin would have to double in size just to service the logistics of plunder. I would need galleons to carry 1/10 part of my rightful share, and then vaults and an army to guard the vaults. These riches loosed upon the world would shake it for generations. My great-great-great-great-grandchildren would relieve themselves in solid gold chamber pots.
Gudrun, said Brangar, is all here as we see it? Is this a glamour?
The mere thought broke me from the hypnotic joy of my contemplation. Gudrun cast a set of carved bones on the ground. We all watched anxiously, but after consulting her signs only briefly, she giggled like a giddy child.
No, Lord. What's gold is gold, as far as we can see. And what's silver is silver, and what's onyx is onyx, and thus wise. This is the greatest trap of all, I said. We shall all die of old age before we can carry it anywhere useful.
We are missing only one thing, said Brangar, and that is our host, who will doubtless prefer to see us die of other causes before we take any of it. But I am content to let it come when it will. To walk amid such splendor is a gift. Let us stay on our guard, but avail ourselves of the courtesy.
And so we wandered Glimraug's garden of imponderable wealth, running our hands over statues and gemstones and shields, caught up in our private entrancements. So often had I won through to a rumored treasure in some dusty tower or rank sewer or mountain cave, only to discover empty, rusting boxes and profitless junk. It was hard to credit that the most ridiculous legend of wealth in all the world had turned out to be the most accurate. Plumes of smoke and mist drifted from vents in the rock beyond the treasure pavilions, and my eyes were drawn to another such plume rising gently from a pile of silver. From there, my attention was snared by a scattering of dark stones upon the surface of the metal coins. I approached and saw that these were rubies, hundreds of them, ranging in color from that of fresh pumping blood to that of faded carnations. I have always been a particular admirer of red stones, and I shook a few into my hands, relishing the clink and glimmer of the facets. The silver coins shifted, and from within them came a blue shape, a yard wide and as long as I was tall. So gently did it rise, so familiar did it seem, that I stared at it for a heartbeat before I realized that it was a hand, a scaled hand, and the dark things glistening at the near ends of its digits were talons longer than my daggers. Delight transmuted to horror, and I was rooted with fear as the still gentle hand closed on mine from beneath, trapping me with painless but inescapable pressure. The difference in scale? Imagine I'd elected to shake hands with a cat, then refused to let go.
Tarcaster Krail,
rumbled a voice that was like a bolt of the finest velvet smoldering in a furnace.
The rubies are most appropriate for contemplation. Red for all the blood that lies beneath this treasure. The million mortals who died in vaults and towers and ships and armies, so that we could take these proud things into our care.
The pile of silver shuddered, then parted and slid to the ground in every direction, displaced by the rising of the creature that had lain inside it, marked only by steaming breath, curling up from nostrils as wide as my head. The arms rose, each a Brangar weight of scaled strength. I gaped at the lithe body, the color of dark sapphire, its back ridges like the thorns of some malevolent flower, its impossibly delicate wings, with membranes that glistened like a steel framework hung with nothing more than moonlight. Atop the sinuous neck was a head somehow vulpine and serpentine at once, with sharp, flat ears that rang from their piercings, dozens of silver rings that would have encircled my neck. The dragon had a mane, a shock of blue-white strands that vibrated with the stiffness of crystal rather than the suppleness of hair or fur. The creature's eyes were black as the sky, split only by slashes of pulsing silver, and I could not meet them. Even catching a glance made my vision flash as though I had stared at the sun. I could not move as the dragon's other hand reached out and closed around my waist,
again with perfect care and unassailable strength. I was lifted like a doll.
I can put the stones back,
I burbled.
I'm sorry.
Oh, that is not true, said the dragon. Its breath smelled like burning copper. And if it were, you would not be the sort of mortal to which we would speak. No, you are not sorry. You are terrified.
Hail, Grimraug the Fair!
Shouted Brangor.
Hail, Sky Tyrant, Shipbreaker, and Night Scathe!
Hail, King on the Waves, son of Erika and Ortild, landless champion, remover of others' nuisances, said Grimraug, setting me down and nudging me to run along as if I were a pet. I gladly retreated to stand with my companions, judging it prudent to toss the rubies back onto the dragon-tossed pile of silver first.
Hail, companions to the king! You have endured every courtesy provided for our visitors, and glimpsed what no mortal has for many years. Have you been dispatched here to avenge some Aja prince? Did we break a tower or two in passing? Did we devour someone's sheep?
We have come for our own sakes, said Brangar. And for yours, and for your treasure as a last resort. We have heard the Hellfalcon Wormsong.
I had no idea what Brangar meant by any of that, but the dragon snorted and bared its teeth.
That is not the usual order in which our visitors lay their priorities, it said. But all who come here have heard the song. What is your meaning?
There are songs, and there are songs beneath songs, are there not?
Brangar removed the leather wrappings of his unused spear. Ash hafted, the weapon had the lethal simplicity of a boar spear, with a pyramidal striking tip forged of some dark steel, with a faint mottle, like flowing water.
Others heard the song of gold, but we have heard the song of the gold taker, the song of your plan, the song of your hope. We have brought ending and eyes.
Have you?
Whispered the dragon, and it was wondrous to see for an instant, just an instant, a break in its inhuman self-regard. It caught its breath, and the noise was like a bellows priming to set a furnace alight, which might have been closer to the truth than I preferred.
Are you in earnest, O King, O companions? Are we in sympathy? For if this is mere presumption, we will give you a death that will take 5 lifetimes to unravel in your flesh. And while you rot, screaming in the darkness, we will pile the corpses of Aja children in a red mound higher than any tower. Your kinfolk will grey and dwindle, knowing that their posterity has been ground into meat for the flies. This we swear by every day of every year of our age, and we have known 10,000.
Hear this! For long months we sought and strove, said Brangor. In Merikos, where the dragon Elusiel fell, where the wizards were said to keep 1 last jar of the burning blood that had seeped from her wounds.
We lost many companions, added Gudrun. The wizards lost everything, including the blood.
For another year, we dispensed with a fortune in Sulagar, said Micah, engaging the greatest of the old masters there in the crafting of black folded steel.
20 spears they made for me, resumed Brangar. 20 I tested and found wanting. The 21st I quenched in the blood of Eluzial and carried north to Helfalkin, and have carried here to be used but once. Its makers call it Adresh, the all-piercing. But I am the one who gave it purpose, and I have named it Glory Kindler.
Glimraug threw back its head and roared. We all staggered, clutching our ears, even Brandgar. The sound rattled the very air in our lungs, and I did not merely imagine that the mountain shook beneath us, for I could see the lanterns bobbing and the treasure piles shaking. Lightning flashed at the rim of the caldera, bolt after bolt, splitting the darkness and painting everything in flashes of golden white. And the thunder that followed boomed like mangonel stones, shattering walls.
Perhaps it is you, said the dragon, when the terrific noises of this display had faded. Perhaps it is you. But know that we are not so base as to tip the scales. Achieve us. Hold nothing back, for nothing shall be held in turn.
This is an excellent doom, said Brangar, and we shall not take it lightly.
The dragon flared its wings, and for an instant their translucence hung like an aura in the night. Then, with a fresh roar of exultation, Glimraug hurled itself into the air, raising a wind that lashed us with dust and shook lanterns from their perches. I felt something close to seasickness, for in the manner of my profession, I had blithely presumed we would make some effort to trick, circumvent, weaken, or even negotiate with our foe, rather than honorably bearing our asses and inviting a kick.
Brangar! I yelled. What in all the hells are we supposed to be doing here?
Something beautiful. Your only task is to survive.
He gave me a powerful squeeze on the shoulder, then pushed me away.
Run, Krail! Keep your wits loose in the scabbard. Think only of living.
Then Glimraug crashed back down, and treasure fountained in a 50-yard radius. Brangar, Gudrun, and Micah evaded the snapping jaws and the buffet of the wings, and now they commenced to fight with everything they had. Gudrun chanted and scattered glass vials from her collection of strange accoutrements, breaking them against the stone, loosing the powers and spirits bound therein. She held nothing back for any more rainy days. Seething white mists rose at Glimraug's feet, and in their miasmic tatters I saw the faces of hungry things eager to wreak harm. The dragon reared, raised high its arms, and uttered darkly hissing words in a language that made me want to loose my bowels. I ran for one of the treasure pavilions, hid behind a stout wooden pillar, and peered around the side to watch the battle unfold. Brangar struck for Glimraug's flank, but the sapphire-scaled worm flicked its tail like a whip, knocking Brangar and his vaunted new spear well away. Micah fared better, dashing under the dragon's forelimbs and heaving themselves into a wing joint, and from there to the ridges of its back. The walls of Gudrun's spirit mist became a column, bone white, wailing as it surged against Glimraug's face and body.
It seemed as if the dragon were attempting to climb a leafless winter tree, and failing, but only for a moment. With a sound like a river rushing swollen in spring's first melt, Glimraug opened wide its maw and sucked Gudrun's ghost substance into its throat, as a man might draw deeply from a pipe. Then it reared again, and blasted the stuff high into the air, trailing flickers of blue and white fire. The spirit mist rose like smoke, and quickly faded from sight against the stars, whatever power it had contained, either stolen or destroyed. Then the dragon lunged with foreclaws for Gudrun, but with a flash of silver she was safe by 20 yards, and hurling her fire gimmicks without dismay. Orange fire erupted at Glimraug's feet, to little effect. Now Gudrun sang further spell songs, and hurled from a leather bag 1,000 grasping strands of spun flax, which sought the dragon's limbs and wove themselves into bindings. Glimraug snapped them in a trice, as you or I might break a single rotten thread, and the golden fibers floated to the ground. Then the dragon's dignity broke, for Micah had made their way up into its gleaming mane, and from there stabbed at one of its eyes. The blade met that terrible lens, I swear, but either luck wasn't with the thief, or the weapon was too commonplace to give more than a scratch. Still, neither you nor I would appreciate a scratch against an eye. And the dragon writhed, trying to fling Micah off. They kept their perch, but only just, and could do little else but hold fast. Glimraug whirled and leapt away from Gudrun with the easy facility of a cat, once more scattering delicate objects far and wide with the shock of its landing. It struck at a pile of silver coins, jaws gaping, and took what must have been tons of the metal into its mouth, as a greedy man might slurp his stew. Then it breathed deep, hissing breath through its nostrils, and its neck bulged with every passage of air. A glow lit the gaps of the scales in the dragon's chest, faint red at first, but swiftly brightening and shifting to blue, then white. Micah cried out and leapt from the dragon's mane, trailing smoke. Their boots and gloves were on fire. The dragon charged back toward Gudrun, mighty claws hammering the stones. The sorceress chanted, and a barrier of blue ice took shape before her, thick and overhanging like the crest of a wave. Glimraug drew in another long breath, then expelled it. And for an instant, the blazing light of its internal fire was visible. Then the dragon breathed forth a stream of molten silver, all that it had consumed and melted, like the great burst of a geyser, wreathed in crackling white flame. The wave of burning death blasted Gudrun's ice shield to steam and enveloped her in an instant. Then came eruption after eruption of green and orange fire as the things she had carried met their fate. I recoiled from the terrible heat and the terrible sight, but to the last she had not even flinched. I was forced to run to another pavilion as rivulets of crackling metal flowed toward me. Glimraug chuckled deep in its throat, orange-hot streams still dripping from between its fangs, and cooling silver black beneath its chin, forming a crust of added scales. Micah howled furiously. They had quenched the flames, and however much pain they must have been bracing against, they did not reveal it by slowing down. Glimraug's claws came down twice, and Micah was there to receive the blow neither time. Once more the thief leapt for the dragon's smoking back, but now they rebounded cannily
and clung to the leading edge of the dragon's left wing. Before the dragon was able to flick them away, Micah pulled out one of their blades and bore down on it with both arms, driving it into the gossamer substance of the dragon's wing membrane. This yielded where the eye had not. Micah slid down as the stuff parted like silk, then fell to the ground when they ran out of membrane, leaving a flapping rent above them. Glimraug instantly folded the hurt wing sharply to its side, as an unwary cat might pull back a paw that has touched hot fireplace stones. Then, heaving itself forward, it whirled tail and claw alike at the Azure thief. Whip-smack, whip-smack. Nearly too late, I realized that the next stroke would demolish my place of safety. I fled and rolled as Glimraug's tail splintered the pavilion. A hard-flung wave of baubles and jewelry knocked me farther than I'd intended. I slid to a halt, one handspan from the edge of a cooling silver stream, and hundreds of coins rolled and rattled past me. I looked up, just in time to see Micah's fabled luck run its course. Stumbling over scattered treasure, at last showing signs of injury, they tried to be elsewhere for the next swipe of a claw, but finally kept the unfortunate rendezvous. Glimraug seized them eagerly and hauled them up before its eyes, kicking and stabbing to the last.
"Like for like," rumbled the dragon,
and with two digits of its free hand, it encircled Micah's left arm, then tore it straight out of the socket. Blood gushed and ran down the dragon's scales. Micah screamed, but somehow raised their remaining blade for one last futile blow. The dragon cast Micah into a distant treasure pavilion like a discarded toy. The impact was bone-shattering. The greatest thief I have ever known was slain and buried in an explosion of blood-streaked gold coins.
"One died in silver, one died in gold," said Glimraug, turning and stalking toward me.
"Targaster Krail won't live to be old," I whispered.
Up went the blood-stained claw. I heaved myself to my knees, wondering where I intended to dodge to, and the claw came down. Well short of me, clutched in pain. Brangar had recovered himself and buried the spear Glory Kindler to the full length of its steel tip in the joint of Glimraug's right wing. The blood that spilled from the wound steamed, and the stones burst into flames where it fell on them. Brangar withdrew the smoking spear and darted back as the dragon turned, but it did not attack. It shuddered and stared at the gash in its hide.
"The venom of Elusil, kin of our kin," said the dragon, with something like wonder. "A thousand wounds have bent our scales, but never have we felt the like."
Rangar spun Glory Kindler over his head, pointed it at the dragon in salute, and then braced himself in a pikeman's stance.
"Never have you faced the like," he shouted. "Let it be here and now."
Ponderously, the dragon turned to face him. Some of its customary ease was gone, but it was still a towering foe, still possessed of fearsome power. With its wings folded tight and burning blood streaming from one flank, it spread its taloned arms and pounced. Brangar met it screaming in triumph. Spear pierced dragon breast, and an instant later, the downsweep of Glimraug's talons shattered the haft of Glory Kindler and tore through Brangar's kingly coat of plate.
The man fell moaning, and the dragon toppled beside him, raising a last cloud of ashen dust. Disbelieving, I stumbled up and ran to them.
"Oh, king," the dragon murmured, wheezing, and with every breath spilling more fiery ichor on the ground. "In all our 10,000 years, we have had but 4 friends, and we have only met them this night."
"Krail, you look awful." Brangar smiled up at me, blood streaming down his face. I saw at once that his wound was mortal. Under smashed ribs and torn flesh, I could see the soft pulse of a beating heart. And a man once opened like that won't long keep hold of his spirit.
"Don't mourn. Rejoice and remember."
"You really didn't want the damned treasure," I said, kneeling beside him. "You crazy Usher. Bring ending and eyes, meaning find a way to kill a dragon and bring a witness when you do it."
"You've been a great help, my friend."
Brangar coughed and winced as it shook his chest.
"I was never made to retire quietly from valor and wait for the years to catch me. None of us were."
"It comes," said Glimrauk. Shaking, bleeding fire, the dragon hauled itself up, then lifted Brangar gently, almost reverently in its cupped hands.
"We can feel the venom tightening around our heart. The long-awaited wonder comes. True death friend, let our pyre be shared. Let us build it now. To take is not to keep."
"To take is not to keep," answered Brangar. His voice was weakening. "Yes, I see. It's perfect. Will you do it while I can see?"
"With gladness, we loose our holds and wards on the fires bound within the mountain."
Glimrauk closed its eyes and muttered something, and the stone shifted below my feet in a manner more ominous than before. I gaped as one of the more distant treasure pavilions seemed to sink into the caldera floor, and a cloud of smoke and sparks rose from where it had gone down. Then another pavilion sank, then another. With rumbling, cracking, sundering noises, the dragon's treasure was being spilled into reservoirs of lava. Flames roared from the cracks in the ground, as wood, cloth, and other precious things tumbled to their destruction.
"What by all the gods are you doing?" I cried.
"This is the greatest of all the dragon hordes that was ever built," said Brangar. "A third of all the treasures our race has dug from the ground, Krail. The plunder of 1,000,000 lives. But there's no true glory in the holding. All that must come in the taking and the letting go."
"You're crazier than the Azure!"
I yelled at Glimrauk, entirely forgetting myself.
"You engineered this place to be destroyed?"
"Not so much as a shaving of scented wood shall leave with you, Darkest Krail."
Glimrauk carefully shifted Brangar into one palm, then reached out and set a scimitar-sized talon on my shoulder. Spatters of dragon blood smoked on my leather jacket.
"Though you leave with our blessing, our arts can bear you to a place of safety."
wonderful. But what the hell is the point?
Cold pain lashed across my face, and I gasped. Glimraug had flicked its talon upward, a casual gesture. And all of you can still see the result, here on my cheek. The wound bled for days, and the scar has never faded.
The point is that it has never been done before,
said Glimraug. Another treasure pavilion was swallowed by fire nearby.
And it shall never be done again. All things in this world are made to go into the fire, Tarkaster Krail. All things raise smoke. The smoke of incense is sweet. The smoke of wood is dull haze. But don't you see? The smoke of gold is glory.
I wiped blood from my face and might have said more, but Glimraug made a gesture, and I found that I could not move. The world began to grow dim around me, and the last I saw of the caldera was Brangar weakly raising a hand in farewell, and the dragon holding him with a tenderness and regard that was not imagined.
Take the story, Krail, called Brangar. Take it to the world.
After a moment of dizzy blackness, I found myself back at the foot of the dragon's anvil, on the gentle path that led up to it from Hailfalkin. The sky was alight with the orange fire of a false dawn. No sooner did I glance back up at the mountain top, then it erupted in an all-out conflagration, orange flames blasting taller than the masts of ships, smoke roiling in a column that blotted out the moons as it rose. Glimraug the Sky Tyrant was dead, and with it my friends Brangar, Gudrun, and Micah. And I, having lost my purse somewhere in the confusion, was now even poorer than I had been before I successfully reached the largest pile of assorted valuables in the history of the whole damn world. I don't know how I made my way down the path without breaking my neck. My feet seemed to move of their own accord. I could perhaps believe that I was alive, or that I had witnessed the events of the night. But I could not quite manage to believe them both at the same time. A crowd came up from Hailfalkin then, armed and yammering, bearing lanterns and an unwise number of wine bottles. And from their exclamations, I gathered that I looked as though I'd been rolled in dung and baked in an oven. They demanded to know what had happened atop the anvil. Most of Hailfalkin had roused itself when the thunder and lightning rolled, and by the time the flames were visible, there wasn't anyone left in bed. My occasionally dodgy instinct for survival sputtered to life then. I realized that the denizens of a town entirely dedicated to coveting a dragon's treasure might not handle me kindly if I told them I had gone up with my friends and somehow gotten the treasure blasted out of existence. The solution was obvious. I told them I had seen everything, that I was the sole survivor, and that I would give the full and complete story only after I had received passage back to the Crescent Cities and safely disembarked from my ship. Thus I made my first arrangement for compensation as a professional storyteller. That, then, is how it all transpired. I heard that various scroungers from Hailfalkin sifted the shattered anvil for years, but the dragon had its way. Every last scrap of anything valuable had been dropped into the molten heart of the mountain, either burned or sunk from mortal reach forever. I retired from adventuring directly, and took up the craft of sitting on my backside at the best place by the fire, telling glib confabulations to strangers, for generally reasonable prices. But one night a year, I don't tell a single lie. I tell a true story about kindred spirits who chose a doom I didn't understand at all when I walked away from it. And one night a year, I turn my bowl over, because the last thing I want to see for my troubles is a little pile of coins reminding me that I am an old, old man. And I sure as hell understand it now.
Rich Larson. Rich Larson was born in West Africa, has studied in Rhode Island and Edmonton, Alberta, and worked in a small Spanish town outside Seville. He now lives in Grand Prairie, Alberta, in Canada. He won the 2014 Dell Award and the 2012 Ranu Prize for Writers of Speculative Fiction. In 2011, his cyberpunk novel, Devolution, was a finalist for the Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award. His short work appears or is forthcoming in Asimov's Science Fiction, the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, Clark's World, Interzone, Lightspeed, DSF, Strange Horizons, Apex Magazine, Beneath Ceaseless Skies, AE, and many others, including the anthologies Upgraded, Future Days, and War Stories. Find him online at richwlarson.tumblr.com. In the tense and atmospheric story that follows, he takes us along to the gritty industrial city of Coalgrid in company with two rogues seeking to unlock the secret of a fabulous treasure, and to find that the situation gets stranger, and the knots they have to unravel more and more complicated with every step they take.
The Coalgrid Conundrum by Rich Larson. The channel was skinned with dark ice that squealed and crackled away under the ship's prow. Apart from that, they entered Coalgrid in silence. For Crane, it was uncharacteristic. He sat spider-like on an overturned crate, elbows resting on bony knees, wide mouth hidden under a thick-knit scarf. His watery blue eyes narrowed to slits as he watched Coalgrid's sprawling factory slide closer. Gilchrist stood, sinewy arms folded, breath escaping as a tendril of steam. He was comfortable in silence, but his dark eyes, normally always scanning, always measuring, looked off to nowhere. On the deck between them sat the strongbox. It was a dull gray cube resting on four small clawed feet, one of which had been cracked in the escape. The sides were filigreed with a carefully crafted pattern of whorls and ripples. The top was ringed with concentric grooves, and in the deepest of them, where Crane's scrubbing hadn't reached, there was still a crust of dried black blood. As the ship moved deeper into the city, the smells of oil and machinery spiked through the cold air. Half the factory still churned, belching smog that hung over the city like an inky cloak, blotting out the stars overhead. "Acrid as ever," Crane finally said. He adjusted his scarf with one long, pale hand. "But from what I've heard of this lockbreaker, I surmise our stay will be brief. We should leave with only partially devastated lungs." "Lucky," Gilchrist said, toneless. The dock approached, lit by phosphor lanterns that glowed bright green in the darkness. The ship's crew stirred to action, cutting speed, making shouted calculations with the dockhands before the pitons launched with a muzzle flash and sharp crack. Thick cables winched them out of the current, reeling them into the mooring, making the ship's frame shiver and groan. "It was unavoidable, Gilchrist," Crane said, as gangplanks thumped down and the hubbub of debarking grew around them. You know that as well as I do. Gilchrist made no reply, but his hands clenched more tightly. Under one thumbnail, where his scrubbing hadn't reached, there was still a sliver of dried black blood. They slipped away from the dock-like shades with the strongbox slung in a makeshift harness between them. The ship's captain had been paid for his averted eyes and persuaded even further by the feathery white gild scar Crane had exposed while adjusting his sleeve. No need for him to know that the criminal organization had been more or less dissolved for months now. Tall lampposts lined Colgrid's streets, topped with the same glowing phosphor as on the dock, lighting a way through thickening smog. A mask vendor was hawking shrilly at the next corner. We should, Gilchrist said. Not many gypsies up here. Colgrid's denizens were pale-skinned and dark-eyed. Crane blended well enough, but Gilchrist's dusky skin could stick in a passerby's memory. If all went well, they would have the strongbox opened and be sailing for warmer climes before anyone could identify them. Crane flicked the vendor 2 silver coins and received 2 masks from the stall in return, flimsier versions of the bug-eyed creation that concealed her entire face. I'm told they now wear these in the courts, Crane said, slipping the mask over his mouth and nose. Fashion is an unpredictable beast, is it not, madam?
Them ones just for show. They don't have a good filter.
The vendor's voice came high and tinny through her mask.
Mine have the best filters.
Gilchrist kept a hand on the strongbox while Crane adjusted his mask, then swapped places to don his own. They continued on, moving deeper into the city, following the directions Gilchrist had memorized in a small, filthy bar on Brask's Wharf. The hour was late and the streets mostly empty. Both tensed when a tall figure emerged from the gloom on impossibly long skeletal legs, but it was only a lamplighter, using the clicking mechanical stilts that were still a rarity everywhere but Colgrid. Each metal shin was painted with a scarlet circle. The same insignia appeared 12 more times as Crane and Gilchrist wound their way through the twisting streets. Sometimes stenciled onto signboards above shops, sometimes painted raggedly straight onto the brick. In the neater versions, they could see it was meant to be a fine-toothed gear. I admit I'm unfamiliar with this particular cipher, Crane puffed, nodding his chin toward the closest. What do you make of it, Gilchrist? A mark of allegiance? Gilchrist touched his arm momentarily, where a guild scar twin to Crane's own was hidden under his sleeve. The guild had never had a strong hold on Colgrid, and now not at all. Vacuums fill quickly, he said. Crane massaged his shoulder and tightened his grip on the sling. A transient snow was starting to fall, small, dirty flakes that didn't touch the ground. They turned into a narrow alley, not marked by any red gear, and startled a small bundle of rags. The child was bony thin, soot-smeared. He, or maybe she, gave a choked sound of surprise and scuttled backward. Gilchrist blinked. He stuck a hand into his pocket and retrieved a handful of crusts from their last meal on board the ship. It's too cold tonight, he said, squatting. You'll lose your toes. There's a heating pipe around back of that smithy 2 streets over. The child snatched the bread away and forced all of it at once into a scabby mouth, then scrambled out of the alley, darting past Crane's knees. Gilchrist's dark eyes trailed after. He took a 1 silver coin from his other pocket and wrapped it in the nest of rags the child had left behind. Crane only watched, expressionless, until Gilchrist stood up and hefted his side of the strongbox. They walked on. The lockbreaker's shop was small, ensconced in shadows, the nearest lamppost smashed. Smoke coiled from a small stack on the roof, and grease-yellow light leaked from slits in the barred windows. No light escaped the door, which was a thick slab of reinforced iron that looked better suited to a jail or a fortress. A deceiver imagines everyone is out to deceive him, Crane said, yanking his mask down around his neck. Perhaps a similar logic applies to lockbreakers. They set the strong box down on the cobblestone with a dull thunk. Crane rubbed his aching shoulder again. Gilchrist studied the door. There was an ornate sort of knocker, shaped like a jaw, that seemed out of place on the otherwise unadorned surface. Crane blew into his reddening hands, then reached for it and took hold. A disguised second jaw sprang from underneath and clamped his wrist in place. Crane flinched, but barely. His lips twisted into a smile as he looked down at his trapped extremity.
"How fortunate it has no teeth," he said.
Gilchrist snorted. The quick knife had slid from his sleeve into his fist, and he was tensed, scanning for ambush. Crane gave an experimental wiggle and shook his head. The metal jaws were tight as a vise. The scratch of moving feet came from behind the door, and a slit shuttered open. An eye ringed with coal appeared in the gap.
"Who the fuck are you?"
came a woman's hoarse voice.
"A man with a great many uses for his left hand, most of which would be severely diminished by frostbite or broken bones," Crane said. "I am called Crane. My companion is Gilchrist. A mutual acquaintance in Brask informed us you might be able to solve a particularly vexing toy puzzle for a price."
There was a muffled click-chunk from some internal mechanism, and the jaws opened. Crane retrieved his hand, rubbing ruefully at his blue-veined wrist. The cold metal had left a purplish welt.
"He said someone was going to try hitting the Thule estate. You pulled it off?"
The lockbreaker's eye widened, and her scratchy voice carried a hint of admiration.
"We are gentlemen, and I resent the suggestion," Crane said blithely. "Will you aid us with the puzzle or not? It's rather conspicuous, and we would prefer to have it off the streets and out of sight as soon as possible."
The lockbreaker hesitated.
"Show me."
Gilchrist slipped the strongbox from its harness and hefted it up to eye level. Its filigreed design gleamed in the yellow light. The lockbreaker's eye narrowed. Then another click-chunk, a series of rattling scrapes as bolts retracted, and the door swung open at last with a slink of steam. The lockbreaker was wide-shouldered, narrow-hipped, dressed all in black. Her pale hair was slicked backward off an angular face. She had deep-set eyes, made more so by the coal, that seemed older than the rest of her. There was a gray smudge on her forehead from an unwashed finger.
"Didn't think anyone would actually have the stones to rob that place," she said. "Heard they flay thieves."
"Do you greet all your customers so vigorously?" Crane asked, rubbing his wrist again as they stepped inside with the strongbox, smelling gunpowder and old metal.
"I'm closed,"
the lockbreaker said.
"Been closed 3 weeks now, and I'm careful."
She turned back to the door and set to locking it again, spinning a brass wheel that drove the bolts into place. From the back, the simple iron door was a patchwork of moving mechanisms. Crane observed it keenly while Gilchrist scanned the shop's interior. Oil lamps provided the yellow light, pulling strange shadows over the objects littering the workbench and hanging from the walls. There were glinting skeleton keys, hooks, and thick needles, what looked like a hand-cranked drill. Dissected locks sat beside their intact neighbors in a scattering of pins and springs. A floor-to-ceiling rack contained hundreds on hundreds of keys, large and small, sleek and spiky, cheap copper and ornate silver, and everything in between. Traces of the lockbreaker's personal effects were scant, but a small table carrying a cracked mug and half-eaten bowl of food was tucked into one corner, and a few shirts dangled from improvised hooks in the ceiling. A shabby rug was tacked unevenly to one wall, and a cylindrical urn sat above the hissing heating pipe. The lockbreaker picked out a square of space on the bench. Crane and Gilchrist set the strongbox down. She examined it with an almost hungry expression on her face, leaning in close, peering from every angle.
"Haven't crossed paths with one of these little bastards for a long time," she said. "It's a dead box. You know that, I hope. You try to force this open with a pry bar, it's spring-loaded to crush whatever's inside.
We know that, Gilchrist said flatly, pulling off his mask. If it was within my abilities, we would not have come seeking yours, Crane said. You've encountered its like before. I assume you can solve this one as well. The lockbreaker's eyes narrowed again. Her mouth thinned.
I can, yeah, she said. For a price, I can.
Of course, Crane said. An expert of your caliber demands suitable compensation. With that in mind, we might be willing to negotiate up to a third, Gilchrist cut in. Crane's face soured. Yes, that. The lockbreaker was silent for a moment, considering. A muscle twitched in her cheek.
No, she said.
No? Crane echoed, a needle tenting the silk of his voice.
Without me, that box isn't worth a pig's shit, she said. Without me, you did that job for nothing, so I figure I get to name my own price, thanks.
Behind her, the quick knife rippled down Gilchrist's sleeve again.
But I don't want money, she continued. I want something else. I want the pair of you to do something for me.
She looked across the room to the gray urn and came slightly unfocused. Her thumb drifted up to her forehead, where the ash stained her skin.
How we mourn a lover in the north, she said. A little every day until the ash is gone. I want you to help me avenge him.
The lockbreaker dragged a pair of splintering stools over to the heating pipe, where Crane and Gilchrist were warming their hands, and told them, like an afterthought, that her name was Merrin. A pleasure, Crane said. Merrin squatted down, nodding her chin toward the urn.
And his name was Petro. He was my husband, more or less. He's been dead 18 days now.
We extend our sincerest condolences, Crane said warily. His gaze flickered back toward the unattended strongbox. Gilchrist, by contrast, was rapt.
I bet you do, Merrin snorted. I don't need you to care. Just need you to understand the situation is all.
She folded her arms on her knees.
Do you know who runs Colgrid?
The Dog, officially, Crane said. But I imagine the balance of power now shifts in favor of the merchants and industrialists. The same change has begun in Brask.
Men of business.
Merrin's voice was thick with contempt.
Brutes, all of them. They worship money and see the world all in numbers.
She clenched her teeth for a moment.
Here in Colgrid, we have the very worst of them. He calls himself Papa Riker. He's nearly as rich as the Dog himself now. 10 times as ruthless.
How did he attain his wealth? Crane asked.
The New World, Merrin said. Same as the rest of them. He was with the trading companies. Mostly narcotics.
Crane and Gilchrist exchanged a glance that did not go unnoticed.
You know the trade? Merrin asked.
A brief foray that proved ill-fated, Crane said, for a variety of reasons. There was a fire, Gilchrist said. Merrin nodded, tonguing her teeth.
You know Shiver?
Not my preferred vice, Crane said, but his eyes brightened. But yes, we're quite familiar. Distilled powder from the Choda plant. Hones the nerves to a razor's edge. He tapped the side of his nose.
Riker is the one who introduced it to the factories,
Merrin said.
They use it to keep the workers from falling asleep. He owns almost half the city now. Competition is bought off or killed off. He's ruthless, how I said. Always looking for a new advantage.
She looked at the urn again.
26 days ago, he wanted me to do some work for him. Petro set up the meeting.
Sabotage? Gilchrist guessed.
Security, Merrin said. Not to keep anyone out. To keep the little imps in. wanted me to rig up a design for adjustable manacles. Their wrists are too skinny, see? And some of them lose a hand altogether in the machinery.
Her nostrils flared.
I told him to go fuck himself.
Crane looked over to Gilchrist. This Riker employs children in his factories?
Sweeps them off the streets and puts them to work, yeah. Mostly on the south side,
Marin said.
Always looking for an advantage, how I said. As close to the devil as you can get. So I refused.
And there was retribution, Crane surmised.
Not the kind I was ready for.
Marin glared at the urn.
My husband was a strong man in many ways. Weak in some ways. When it came to drink or to drug, Petro was weak.
She blinked hard.
The last few years, it was Shiver. Never too bad. Never bad enough to make me put a stop to it. I even did it with him, every so often.
Her voice turned fierce.
A week after I refused the job, I found Petro in our bed, pale as snow. Dead, with Shiver smeared around his nose. I tested some of the powder on a rat the next day, and it was how I thought. Someone gave him a tainted pinch, laced it with cyanide.
Silence seeped into the cramped space. Crane glanced to Gilchrist again, but Gilchrist was staring at the urn almost as intently as Marin. And in what manner did the rat die? Crane asked. The lockbreaker's face darkened.
Badly, she said. So that's my price. That's how Riker has to die. Badly.
Vengeance is a natural proclivity, Crane said. I indulge in it myself from time to time. But we are only three, and of the three, only you are familiar with this Riker and with the general environ. Gilchrist and I are strangers here.
Better that way,
Marin said.
Walls have ears these days. Don't know who to trust. That's why not another soul in Colgrid knows what I've got planned.
To speak frankly, Madame Marin. Crane picked a piece of lint from his knee, peered at it, and cast it aside. You would do better to open the strongbox and use your more than generous allotment of the contents to hire an assassin. We may even be able to put you into contact with one. Marin's gaze was defiant.
If you got into that estate and out in one piece, you can do this job easy. The price stands.
Crane opened his mouth to riposte. We'll do it, Gilchrist said. His black eyes were gleaming. You have a plan? Marin exhaled a long breath. She looked more closely at Gilchrist, then nodded.
Yeah. Haven't thought about much else since Petro.
She turned to Crane.
You're the talker, he's the doer. Is that it?
Such things are never so simple as they first appear, Crane said flatly. But if no other payment can satisfy you, then Mr. Gilchrist speaks for us both. We will aid you in your revenge.
Good.
Marin rose and went to the urn, hesitating only a moment before she dipped her fingers inside. She turned back to them. The ash was smooth and cool against Gilchrist's hand, then Crane's, as they shook. The queue of workers stretched from the factory gate all the way around the corner, ragged men and women stamping their feet and rubbing their arms against the cold. Some of them pulled their filter masks down long enough to puff at the clay pipe being passed from hand to grimy hand. Crane and Gilchrist kept theirs on as they tacked themselves to the end of the line. A rather ghastly piece of architecture, isn't it? Crane remarked, tipping his head back to observe the factory. Its high brick walls were stained jet black from soot and displayed no windows. The wrought iron gates were topped with wicked-looking spikes, and the scaly roof was dominated by several enormous smokestacks already leaking their ink into the sky. Not many points of egress, Gilchrist said. They stepped out of the queue and reinserted themselves farther along, aided by Crane opening the tin of snuff from his coat pocket and Gilchrist delivering a winding elbow to the gut of the one worker who protested. Up close, they could see the gate itself, guarded by a pair of scowling watchmen with truncheons. The red gear was painted on their chest plates. Both guards snapped to attention as the clockwork clatter of a strutter echoed up the cobblestones. One of them made his way along the line, brandishing his truncheon, snarling for single file. The workers shuffled themselves. So did Crane and Gilchrist. All of them turned to watch the strutter clack up the street like a massive black insect, limbs churning in perfect synchronization, pulling a black carriage behind. Whispers traveled up and down the queue as the carriage passed with curtains drawn. The top of it was racked and loaded with three squat barrels, all of them secured tightly by cables. The strutter shuddered to a halt at the gate, and its driver dismounted, yanking off her grease-stained gloves before opening the carriage door. The man who descended was massive, thick-shouldered, with a broad chest and sizable paunch, only somewhat disguised by the precise tailoring of his black and scarlet waistcoat. His fine clothes were at odds with his bulk, and with the boxer's hands, gnarled and scarred, that escaped his sleeve cuffs. The wide ruffs splayed around his neck might have looked affected on another man. On Riker, it gave him the look of a cannibal lizard from the New World. The impression was strengthened by his ornate filter mask, angled like the snout of a beast and inlaid with silver teeth locked in a razor-sharp grin. Riker adjusted his cuffs while a pock-faced porter started unloading the barrels from the top of the carriage. When he wobbled under the last of them, Riker gave a snort of impatience and took it from his grasp, setting it on one bow-broad shoulder as if it weighed nothing at all. Marin failed to mention the man was a virtual colossus, Crane said, watching closely as Riker, accompanied by a swirl of attendants, strode toward the factory doors. Moves light, Gilchrist said, watching his gait. A tremor of anticipation moved through the queue as the other two barrels passed by. One of the men whose thumb was stained from snuff broke into a gapped grin.
Big shipment, he said. Heard it's purer than last one. Pure, pure.
Crane sucked air between his teeth. This is a rather extravagant quantity of narcotic, Gilchrist, he murmured. Three barrels, already processed. Worth a small fortune, I imagine. Gilchrist calculated. Double and a half the weight in silver. How the conflagration still haunts me, Crane said mournfully. Only pennies to what's in the strongbox, Gilchrist reminded him. One attendant handed Riker a manifest on thick parchment. Another stretched to mutter something into his ear. Riker turned toward the line of workers, all of whom fell dead silent.
50 only today, he said, in a voice thinned by the filter mask. Preference to those already marked. Rest of you, fuck off.
Half the queue surged forward excitedly, nearly bowling Crane and Gilchrist over in their hurry to bare their wrists, scratching away grime to expose the blotted red ink stamped there. Others howled in disappointment. A few furtively tried to spit and rub the ink from a neighbor onto their own skin. Small scuffles broke out where the guards moved to establish the cutoff point. An emaciated woman with wild gray hair broke through and darted at Riker.
My Scaddy! My little Scaddy! Where is she?
She wailed, grabbing for him.
She has a cough. Let me in! I'll work harder than anyone! I swear I will!
Riker half turned and swatted her away with the back of his fist, sending her sprawling. Her skull bounced off the cobblestone with a wet smack. He looked down at her for a moment, watching impassively as she moaned and babbled. Then a guard hurried to drag her away, and Riker continued through the factory gate, returning his attention to the parchment. Crane and Gilchrist stood still a second longer, then melted back through the clamoring workers, back the way they'd come. Gilchrist's hands were clenched to fists. They were around the corner and out of sight, moving down a dirty alley, when Crane spoke.
There is no ledger, Gilchrist.
Gilchrist looked up.
Meaning what, Crane? His voice was brusque. You have a marvelous way with accounts and balances, Crane said. But in matters of morality, there is no ledger. You cannot wash one man's blood off your hands using another's. Gilchrist's broad back stiffened. He stopped walking. You think that's what I'm doing? Crane yanked the filter mask down from his mouth. Assuaging your guilt, yes, by assuring yourself there are men far more evil than we are, and by removing one from existence, he said. It's delusional, self-indulgent. It doesn't become you. It's how we get the strongbox open, Gilchrist said. Crane scoffed. You were ready to force her to do it, he said. At knife point. It was her tragic tale that swayed you, that and the fact that our target employs children. Or do I misremember? Gilchrist gave a tight shrug. I saw threats wouldn't work. Not on her. She has nothing to lose. So she would have us believe, Crane grated. Yet she was unable to correctly describe the effects of cyanide poisoning. Why is that? Gilchrist started to walk again. Not everyone knows poisons, Crane. We would do better to take the strongbox elsewhere. The blue veins of Crane's neck were taut, and his voice was ice. We are working in unfamiliar territory with an ally who, I believe, is not entirely forthcoming. He strode after his companion. Dealing with the individual we just observed, I suspect any error at all might be disastrous. Riker does not strike me as a man one attempts to kill twice. Gilchrist kept his eyes forward. Lucky we only need to do it once. Crane's long legs overtook him. Your reticence is growing tiresome, he snapped. I want to discuss what occurred during our escape from the Thule estate. I remember what happened. You slit a man's throat before he could cry warning, Crane said. Had you not, we would both be dangling from the gallows even now. You exchanged his life for ours, as I would have done in the same situation. He reached to seize onto Gilchrist's shoulder. Gilchrist whirled and locked his arm, slamming him into the soot-stained brick of the alleyway. His lips pulled back off his teeth. The watchman had children, he said. I saw their shoes after, outside the guardhouse. You did the reconnaissance. You never mentioned it. Crane blinked down at the unfamiliar sight of Gilchrist's forearm under his windpipe. Rage twisted across his face for a moment, then receded. It wasn't pertinent, he said, enunciating each word. To you, Gilchrist finished. And he had ash on his forehead. Saw it while I was stashing the body. That means no mother for them. That means they end up in the street, or sold off to some factory. There are worse fates, Crane said defiantly. You survived similar beginnings. His expression was calm, but his ears were scarlet red. Gilchrist stepped back, dropped his arm. That's what I mean, Crane. He croaked a half laugh. The last thing I want is to make more of me. Crane rubbed his throat. He said nothing. When they arrived back at the lock shop, Gilchrist forewent the knocker and rapped out the agreed-upon pattern against the door with his fist instead. This time Marin was quicker to let them inside. There was new ash on her forehead.
You saw him? Saw his mask?
She asked, pulling a rubbery cup away from her ear and flopping its attached tube over her shoulder. The strong box was sitting in the center of the workbench, surrounded by an array of skeleton keys and picks, one of which was sticking out from the locking groove.
Been listening, she explained, shutting the door behind them. It's sticky in there. Something spilled on it.
Wine, Gilchrist said. He took a seat on one of the stools. Crane stood, pale hands sunk in his pockets. We saw the mask.
He hardly takes it off,
Marin said.
Had it specially made by an artisan from Lenza.
She reached under the workbench and produced a thin tracing in carbon.
This wasn't easy to nab. Don't spill no wine on it.
Crane and Gilchrist looked down at the tracing, which showed the mask's design from the front,
then in profile, then cross-sectioned.
It's bigger than it needs to be, Marin said. Room to make improvements.
She overlaid the sheet with another, this one bearing her own pen strokes. Coiled springs and wedges folded against themselves, some sort of trigger mechanism. It was only when she brought the realized product from under the workbench, unwrapping wax paper from its metal shell, that they saw the sharpened spikes studding the inside. Crane touched his wrist where the spring-loaded knocker had clamped down on it the night before. How ingenious.
These won't be visible after I line it, she said,
running a finger down one of the spikes.
Hand me that bowl, would you?
Gilchrist passed her the thick-bottomed clay bowl without speaking. She flipped it over, then set the metal shell down on top of it. The spiked jaws snapped with a deep crack. When she lifted the shell, the bowl fell to the bench in fragments and powder. Her expression was both eager and slightly ill.
How do we get a hold of the mask? Gilchrist asked.
Marin chewed the inside of her cheek.
Not from his quarters, she said. Where he lives, it's a fucking labyrinth, and it's locked down tighter than any place I've ever seen.
She swept the remnants of the bowl off the bench's surface with one hand.
But there's a bathhouse he goes to. That's where you plant it. Then you leave without him ever even seeing you.
Crane looked down at the device. Remote assassinations do not always go as planned, he said. What if the mechanism were to fail?
It won't, Marin said firmly. It's been tested plenty.
Very well.
Crane looked down at the schematic, avoiding Gilchrist's eye. But leaving the sabotaged mask in its proper place without arousing suspicion fulfills our contract. If your device fails, it is no responsibility of ours. You will open the strongbox regardless.
It'll work,
Marin said, running her tongue along her gums.
But yes, I open the box regardless.
She inserted a crank into a slot in the metal shell and began to wind it tight again, click after rasping click. The bathhouse was an incongruous slab of gleaming black stone amid the scab-colored brick and slant roofs that surrounded it. Geometric hieroglyphs carved over the doorway and the roof's beveled edges evoked the abandoned ziggurats of the New World, as if the building had been cleaved whole from the rainforests and dropped in the center of Colgrid. It was a clumsy imitation at best. Crane and Gilchrist had seen the sleeping cities, with their towering temples and intricate catacombs deep under the earth, and knew no living architect could ever approximate them. But perhaps Riker had seen them too, and the bathhouse served him as a small reminder.
Strutter's coming, Gilchrist said.
Crane drew himself up to his full height, adjusting the brim of a scooped hat with a sewn-in filter mask. The stolen clothes were slightly baggy on his frame, but of good quality, and Marin had assured him many gentlemen's clothes were ill-fitting ever since Shiver caught on in the courts. The two of them had spent the better part of the day observing the bathhouse comings and goings, checking its exterior against the stained parchment where Marin had sketched a layout, all with a garrote wire silence stretched between them. It was a simple enough plan. According to a former attendant they'd bribed, Riker always went to the steam rooms first, near the back, then made a quick, cold plunge before leaving. The whole visit took no more than 15 minutes. That was time enough for Crane to crack the locked cupboard with Riker's effects in it, especially with Marin's superior tools. Gilchrist would be monitoring the steam room from the outside, ready to call warning should Riker leave early. Now the distinctive black strutter was rounding the corner, and it was time to part ways. Gilchrist into the alley, Crane toward the bathhouse entrance. As he swaggered toward the entry, Crane put a thumb to his reddened nostril and snorted sharp. The rush of powder through membrane made him shudder. It wasn't his drug of choice, but Shiver was cheap and temptingly plentiful here. He'd bought a pinch in the factory queue and another behind the bathhouse while Gilchrist was otherwise occupied. Colgrid's dirty streets turned clear and bright and slightly vibrating, the effect that gave the narcotic its name. He felt the high like a razor blade, like his every step and motion was slicing through a slower, thicker world. Riker seemed to move through syrup as he stepped from the strutter, trailed by a sole attendant carrying a fabric bag. At the entrance, Crane paused his stride, bowed at the precise angle that hid his face entirely, and let the giant man pass first. He managed to seem even larger on Shiver, as if the bunched muscles of his arms and shoulders were swelling and straining to escape his skeleton. He gave Crane a brief glance through the lenses of his filter mask. Crane had an unbidden image of Riker's head imploding and spattering the insides of the lenses with greasy blood and gray matter. He had to lash down his chemical smile as he followed him into the antechamber, flicking a coin to the boy waiting by the door and receiving a cupboard key in return. He took one side of the coal-heated benches, and Riker took the other. Riker was half-shielded by his attendant as he stripped down, but from the glimpse Crane caught, the whole of his bulk was netted with scars. Gilchrist wedged himself into the corner of the furnace room and steam room, cramming low and yanking off his filter mask to put an eye against the knot hole he'd drilled earlier. He breathed through his mouth. The back alley had a strong stink of tanning chemicals that he hoped would keep passers-by to a minimum. If anyone did see him, the ragged coat he'd fished from the gutter would make him look like a beggar seeking warmth as the sunlight waned. He blinked. He could see a few silhouettes lounging on the benches, steam swirling around their midsections, but none with Riker's size.
"What are you doing?"
Gilchrist whirled. There was less soot on the child's face this time. He could tell she was a girl. She rocked back and forth on the balls of her feet, rubbed at her left shoulder.
"You gave me the coin, didn't you?" she said vaguely. "Think it was you, not the tall one."
She peered between him and the hole in the wall, then made a wanking gesture in the air.
"You a pervert, then?"
Gilchrist took another coin from his pocket. When she snatched for it, he closed his fist and put a finger to his lips. Tapped his wrist where a timepiece would sit, once, twice, three times. She nodded solemnly and clapped a dirty hand over her mouth. He hunkered down again, squinting through the knothole. Crane peeled off his stolen clothes and walked to the warm baths, smooth stone whispering against the soles of his feet. He nodded to the other occupants, then lowered himself in at a stretch of gleaming black wall polished reflective. The hot water tingled and stung at his cold skin. His reflection was ghostly, distorted. Deep dark circles beneath the eyes and a bruise blooming at his collarbone where Gilchrist had pinned him. He traced it gently with one finger, then dug into it and made it sear. Behind his reflection, Riker passed by like a thunderhead, the attendant trailing behind with towel and scrubber. No bather looked up. Crane waited a beat in the water, was tempted to wait longer. But he got out and doubled back to the antechamber. Empty, aside from the boy wiping down the benches.
"What slobbering ignoramus runs the furnace today?"
Crane demanded, punching out his syllables in the harsh coal-grid accent. The boy flinched, nearly dropping the rag.
"I could better warm the baths with my piss," Crane said. "Tell them, more coal. Tell them, a fucking plenitude of coal."
The boy scrambled away. Crane went to his own cupboard first, pulling on his oversized trousers and knotting them with one hand. He took Marin's picks from the inside of the hat, where the skull crusher was concealed, and moved to the cupboard he'd watched Riker's attendant wrestle shut. The shiver had receded to a clear, singing focus that would keep his hands smooth. Crane eyeballed the lock and selected the second narrowest pick.
"Were you born in the desert?"
the girl asked for the third time.
"You're dark all over."
Gilchrist wiped a trickle of sweat before it could slide into his eye. He focused through the steam. Riker had the room mostly to himself. The other bathers had drifted away when he entered, their body language twitching nervous. Through the other wall, he could hear voices arguing in the furnace room about the definition of a plenitude.
You and the tall one, you staying in the widow shop? The girl said, scratching her shoulder. Followed you from there. Best be careful.
The words prickled the back of his neck, but Gilchrist kept watching the knothole.
Why's that?
He asked, keeping his voice low and even. The girl's reply came in a solemn whisper.
Because she got a musket, and she shot her husband dead.
Gilchrist looked up. The girl made the shape of a muzzle with her fingers.
Bam! His skull went all apart like an old fruit.
She screwed up her face.
So best be careful.
Who told you that story? Gilchrist asked.
It's not a story,
the girl said scornfully, scratching at her shoulder again more vigorously.
I seen it. Papa Riker sent me to keep my eyes on her. I seen it happen.
She gave a devilish smile.
Made an awful mess on the wall.
Gilchrist stared straight ahead for a moment, recalling the interior of the lock shop.
Crane's a bastard when he's right, he muttered, then put his fingers to his mouth and whistled three long, mournful notes.
Crane was a tumbler away, two at most, when the faint but unmistakable call of a New World carrion bird reached his ears. He froze, cursed. The clear-out call meant something had gone wrong, meant Riker could be barreling in at any moment, but he was so close. He steadied his hands and leaned in, feeling for the next catch. The wet slap of approaching feet sounded from the corridor. Close. Crane gritted his teeth. He tore the pick free, seized his shirt and shoes and hat last as he slipped out the door. The inside of the lock shop was thick with shadows. Marin had only lit one lamp. When Gilchrist set the skull crusher down on the workbench, just inside the pool of light, she stared at it blankly for a moment before she spoke.
What happened?
We have a similar query, Crane said. Regarding your husband's death, your version of events is under dispute, and if we cannot trust your information, we cannot trust you to maintain your end of our bargain.
Why did you kill him? Gilchrist asked.
Marin gave a choked laugh.
The fuck are you talking about?
A musket ball at close range, Crane said. Here in this very shop. He circled the cramped room in a few long strides, stopping at the threadbare rug hanging on the wall. Such a death would leave traces. He reached for the corner of the rug.
Don't!
Marin's voice came in a snarl. She was standing, breathing hard, her hands balled into fists. Then, all at once, her face crumpled. She dropped back down onto the stool, laying both hands flat on the bench. One of her fingers jumped.
I never meant to fire it,
she said, looking at her hands first, then up at Crane and Gilchrist. Her black-rimmed eyes were hollow.
Only to keep him back.
She blinked.
He was given laced shiver. That was the truth. But it wasn't laced with poison. It was ichor.
Gilchrist didn't flicker at the word, but Crane's eyes narrowed.
The rage drug, he clarified. Secreted by a particularly venomous New World toad. Extremely rare. That's how I know it was Riker who did it, Marin said. Only he'd have access to that stuff.
Describe it. Crane's voice was intent, almost eager.
Describe the effects.
Marin's nostrils flared.
Fuck you!
You've attempted to deceive us once already, Crane said. Why would we accept your word now without—
His veins were like ropes!
Marin paused, took a shuddering breath.
When he came down the stairs, he was sweating and all his veins were like thick ropes. His cock was hard. And he was talking. Not in any language, just talking. Gibberish.
How did he behave? Crane asked, folding his arms.
Tranced at first, Marin said thickly. I tried to get him to sit down. Then, angry. Like an animal. Like an animal in my husband's body.
She waved a hand over her eyes.
There was nothing back there. He was gone in the head. I tried to calm him down,
She swallowed. Tried to calm him down. Couldn't. He got his hands around my throat. I barely slipped him. Musket was on the table. He chased me.
Her gaze raked around the room, seeing ghosts in motion, then came to rest on the hanging rug.
Told him to back up. He didn't. He grabbed my wrist, and I pulled the trigger.
Crane nodded with something like reverence. Iker is incredibly potent, he said. Even in the smallest doses, it causes violent hallucinations, inflames the carnal urges, occasionally induces a form of glossolalia as well. He drummed his long fingers against his elbow. Little wonder it was considered a myth in the early years of exploration.
Riker helped cover up Petro's killing, Gilchrist said. Told everyone he'd gone south to dodge a debt. That right?
Yes, Marin said bitterly. He'll ask me for another job someday, and he knows I'll do it if I don't want to end up imprisoned for Petro's murder. You see why I hate him? See why I have to kill him, don't you?
Gilchrist looked at her for a moment, then nodded.
You have to kill him because you aren't sure, he said. You aren't sure if he gave Petro the Iker, or if Petro took it himself and misjudged the potency.
Marin snarled.
He wouldn't.
The barflies of the inner city say otherwise, Crane interjected. By all accounts, your husband was not sound in mind or in spirit during the months leading up to his disappearance. He experimented with the more exotic narcotics. He spoke often of death.
I know that, Marin snapped. I know he wasn't well, but he would never.
Riker might have spread the rumor of your husband's debt in order to deflect attention from his own role, Crane said. The Dog would not react kindly to Riker selling Iker to Colgrid citizenry.
If you kill Riker without knowing the truth, you'll wonder, Gilchrist said. Forever.
Marin's eyelids dropped shut.
What are you suggesting, then?
She asked, voice cracked.
An amendment to our bargain, Crane said. You need a confession, not a mere execution. Confessions can be extracted with the proper leverage.
If you think Riker would ever confess to giving Petro the Iker, you're a simpleton.
Leverage, Crane repeated.
As of this morning, Riker is storing 3 barrels of shiver in the Southside factory. That represents a sizable investment. Marin opened her eyes.
What? Steal it?
More take it hostage. Gilchrist said. We know someone who can get us inside. Tonight.
He cocked his head toward the sound of a small fist rapping low on the door.
That'd be her.
When the night was sufficiently dark, they trooped out of the shop into the cold streets. The girl scampered ahead of them. Her name was Scatty, and the shoulder she always scratched had a messy red gear tattooed into the skin. She'd shown it to them with a mixture of pride and resentment. Then, without ever looking at Marin directly, she'd explained how Riker had ordered her to watch the lock shop on the day of Petro's death, and how after relaying the news to him, she'd never returned to the factory how she was supposed to. But she still knew how to get back in without anyone seeing her. She knew where the guards patrolled and half of their names. She knew the 3rd smokestack was no longer in use. She'd hovered over Gilchrist's shoulder, chewing dates from Marin's larder, as he sketched out the factory's dimensions. Their shadows stretched long and slender as they passed under the 1st phosphor lamppost. Gilchrist carried coiled rope and the improvised grapple Marin had put together. Crane's long fingers toyed with the file he'd mixed over the heating pipe. Marin was strapped with her lock-breaking tools. All of them wore filter masks. And Marin had dug out one for Scatty, too, after the girl emptied her pockets of all the keys she'd filched while they were sketching out the factory's dimensions and arguing about entry and egress. They stopped a street behind the Southside factory. Crane took out the glass file and tapped one frayed fingernail against it. Tendrils of luminous yellow swirled inside. Skadi watched with undisguised fascination as he capped it with a tiny pipette.
I want to use it too, she said, yanking her mask down.
Lamprey extract requires successive doses to be effective, Crane said, tipping his head back, peeling back an eyelid. I'm afraid you would see only a blur. He squeezed a drop into one eye, then the other. When he finished blinking, his pupils were swollen wide with a silvery gleam to them. Gilchrist took the file from him and did the same.
What do you see? Skadi asked.
The light human eyes miss, Gilchrist said. You ready, Marin?
Marin pulled down her mask. Her face was drawn, but her voice came steady.
Haven't done a break-in for about a decade, she said. Always feel a bit sick until the entry. Let's get on with it.
One of the night watchmen was sauntering along the back of the factory, singing hoarsely and occasionally tapping his truncheon against the brick for percussion. They watched from the shadows until he rounded the corner, then Skadi led the way to the wall, almost skipping.
See the cracks? She whispered. You should be able to see them. I can barely, but I know where they all are anyways.
Crane and Gilchrist looked up the brick wall to see where the mortar had eroded, leaving the cracks Skadi used for her climb. Large enough for a child's hand and toe holds, nothing more, but they'd anticipated as much. Gilchrist unspooled the rope and handed the grapple off to Crane. He judged the distance to the carved gutter that rimmed the roof, made two practice swings, and cast it. The grapple sailed up through the dark, rope ribboning out behind it like a startled snake. Its hooks clattered against the angled surface, sliding, scraping, finally catching. Soot caked on the roof softened the noise, but they still waited, breath bated, for watchmen voices. A moment passed. Another. Crane tugged the rope taut and offered it to Marin. She dusted her hands with chalk from her pouch and stretched her arms, then started to climb. She was barely over the top when Skadi followed, quick as a cat. Gilchrist reached for the rope next, but paused.
Why do you agree to hit the factory? He asked.
Crane snorted.
Your sketch of the exterior was remarkably detailed, considering it was done from memory, he said. You would have ended up here whether I agreed or not, in order to liberate a cadre of orphans.
Gilchrist fixed him with a long look.
You came to skim some of the shiver, he said. I suppose we are each in our own way predictable.
Crane paused.
Will this balance your ledger, then? Will you be satisfied? More than the drug ever satisfies you.
Two entirely different matters, Crane said, but quietly, as Gilchrist churned up the rope with his feet barely grazing the wall for support. Crane followed, coiling the rope up behind him as he went. From the top, they could see Colgrid's crooked roofs and belching chimneys spilling into the distance, dotted with the green phosphor blaze of street lamps. They only lingered long enough for Crane to unhook the grapple before making their way along the factory's spine to the disused smokestack Skadi had pinpointed on Gilchrist's crude map.
Rungs on the inside for when we used to go up to clean it, the girl said. Nice and easy for you.
Crane cast again, but this time the grapple bounced, clanging off the rim of the smokestack and back to the roof. Marin had to hop backward to avoid its impaling her foot. She hissed a curse. Crane only gave an irritable shrug. He retrieved the grapple, measured, and this time found the edge of the smokestack. The descent was cramped and slow, the rungs all slippery with soot, the cloying smell of chemical leaking through their masks' filters. Crane and Gilchrist led the way, their augmented vision painting the pipe with silvery brushstrokes, letting them see the accumulated sediment scabbing the walls and pass up whispered warnings of the rungs that were rusted weak or missing entirely. Before the bottom, where the shaft connected to the boiler, they found a small metal door in the dark, as Skadi had promised. It came open with a sharp creak, and Gilchrist squeezed through, twisting his wide shoulders. Crane next, easily as an eel. Then Marin contorted herself to follow. Skadi levered herself through last. It was a short drop to the base of the boiler, and after the tight confines of the smokestack, the vaulted factory interior felt the size of a cathedral. Rows of spiky black machinery stretched from back to front, looming out of the dark like mechanical monsters, their bared cogs grinning teeth. Scatty's shoulders hunched at the sight. She rubbed furiously at the left one.
"Storeroom's back there," she murmured, pointing with her whole hand. "Locked up, good."
She looked around the factory again and shook herself.
"I hate this place lots."
She led the way down the row, and as they walked, soles scuffing on soot, pale faces poked out from the machinery. Some of them whispered. One called Scatty's name in a wavering question. Crane put a bony finger to the place where his mask covered his lips. There was straw spread out underneath the machinery. Moth-eaten blankets, too. A few of the children huddled alone. Most tangled together for body heat or for comfort.
"Hush, hush, hush," Scatty said. "How asleep is the nanny?"
"Two and some,"
one of the children whispered.
"Amalia took the sum."
They found the nanny slumped up ahead in a carved wooden chair, three empty bottles lined beside him, grizzled chin resting on his chest. Crane paused long enough to pour laudanum into his half-open mouth to make sure he stayed that way. More of the children were waking now, and there was a sound of scraping metal as they shifted. Marin pointed down at a foot that wasn't tucked under blankets. The child's ankle was cuffed in a heavy iron attached to a long cable that ran the length of the factory floor.
"Bastards," she said softly. "Looks like an easy pick, though."
They moved on to the storeroom, which was bricked into the back corner of the factory and secured by a heavy wooden door.
"Go faster with a bit of light,"
Marin said, running her fingers over its thick lock.
"I don't have lamprey shit in my eyes."
Gilchrist turned.
"Scatty,
get a candle."
The girl vanished and returned a moment later with a burned-down nub of wax. She crouched, watching intently as Marin laid out her tools on the floor in a neat line. The lockbreaker held out a few simple picks. Gilchrist and Crane took one each, then went back down the row. Gilchrist worked one side and Crane the other, rousing the children who were still asleep, muffling the occasional startled yelp, pointing to the ankle iron, jiggering it open. They made it nearly all the way down when voices came from the factory entrance.
"See if the old drunk's got something for us, too," a watchman coughed. "Go on, just check. Fucking dull out here."
Crane and Gilchrist exchanged a look. Crane motioned the children to cover their ankles and be still, then swept toward one side of the entry, pulling on his gloves. Gilchrist took up position at the other, moving like a shadow. The quick knife was in his hand, the blade telescoping and clicking into place. His jaw clenched. The iron door swung open, and the watchman's lantern pierced the gloom. In the same instant, Crane sucked in his breath, pulled a burnt orange pellet from his pouch, and crushed it between his palms. The watchman took a few steps inside, then hesitated. He fumbled with the strap of his filter mask. Motes of powder from Crane's stained gloves were clouding into the air, a foul, peppery smell accompanying. One of the children started to sneeze. Crane's eyes were leaking tears and mucus was spotting his mask. He still hadn't breathed in. The watchman took another faltering step, then spun.
"Ask him yourself, you sheepfucker," he said, hauling the factory door shut behind him, his voice turning faint. "You didn't tell me there was a spill today. Smells like the devil in there."
They waited another heartbeat. Another. They waited for the sound of boots to disappear. As soon as the watchmen were gone back to the gate, Crane darted over to the barrel of drinking water and plunged his face inside. He emerged with a curse that made the children's ears prick up as Gilchrist picked the last few cuffs.
"Rather more potent than my previous recipe,"
Crane muttered, stripping off the stained gloves.
"Good."
Gilchrist used the ladle to splash water into his bloodshot eyes. Then they moved back down the row, the freed children trailing after them, murmuring to each other, some of them knuckling their eyes still from the pellet. When they got to the storeroom, Marin was lifting her mask to wipe sweat off her forehead.
Close thing, that watchman coming in, she said. Good work, whatever you did.
She shoved the wooden door, and it swung open smoothly on its hinges. Inside, among the crates and stacked metal, the three barrels of shiver stood clustered together.
They look heavy, Marin muttered.
Then let's not waste time, Crane said, eyes gleaming. He tipped the first barrel, and Gilchrist caught it from the other side, lowering it to the floor to be rolled. The three of them worked quickly, moving the barrels into position by the smokestack. Scatty and a few older girls managed to herd the children into a group, quieting the talkers with hissed admonishments or smacks up the head. When all three barrels of shiver were in place, Crane gingerly fished more of the orange pellets from his pouch and passed them out among the older children.
These are intended to be thrown, not crushed in hand, and certainly not ingested, he said. Not for eating, understood?
A few nods. I have a query, children, he continued. What happens when one pokes a ball of cave spiders? The children looked at each other for a moment.
Go everywhere, one of the boys finally mumbled.
Others made scurrying motions with their fingers.
Yes, Crane said. So, when we open the factory door, all of you must be little cave spiders, scattering in all directions.
He lifted one of the pellets between two fingers.
And should a watchman move to grab you? These are your stingers.
The children nodded, every single one of them, and Scatty's grin gleamed in the dark. Morning over Colgrid. The rising sun drenched the sky red outside Marin's window. The lockbreaker was boiling a pot of tar-black coffee. Crane and Gilchrist were sitting by the heating pipe, the blankets they'd slept on briefly now piled at their feet. During the chaos created by the fleeing children, they'd gone back up the smokestack and down from the roof. The last they'd seen of Scatty was her leading her little band into the streets, whooping and shrieking.
Betty's flogging the watchman, Marin said. Betty thinks they helped us.
All the better, Crane said, tapping a pen against his cheekbone as he considered the letter lying in mid-composition across his lap.
Ambiguity is our ally. How does this strike you both?
He stroked out the final sentence and raised the parchment to the light.
My dearest Mr. Riker, you are cordially invited to join me at the corner of the Four Angels at midnight, unaccompanied and unarmed, so that we might negotiate an exchange of goods and services. If I sight anyone in your employ within a block of our meeting point, or sense any threat to my person, your barrels will burn. Signed, your loving thief.
Marin snorted.
Won't think it's me, that's for certain.
Seal it, Gilchrist said, with a pinch of the shiver. Crane grudgingly opened one of the tiny bags he'd filled from the last barrel. He tapped a bit of powder onto the flat of Marin's kitchen knife, then held it over the heating pipe until it bubbled and melted to a distinctive tarry brown Riker would recognize. It smeared like hot wax over the fold of the letter.
He won't come alone, Marin said, taking the letter as it cooled and stiffened. Or unarmed.
You won't either, Gilchrist said. Marin hesitated for a moment. Then she set the letter aside and reached under the workbench, hauling the strongbox out into the light and lifting the rough-spun shroud over top of it. The locking grooves were pinned with calipers and a tiny section of metal had been peeled back, exposing part of the mechanism where two skeleton keys speared inside.
Had it cracked yesterday already, she admitted. Once you know the trick to them, they're not so bad.
She pointed at the keys.
That one clockwise, the other opposite. You can do the honors if you like.
The men exchanged a glance. Then Crane took the left, Gilchrist the right, and they twisted without hesitation. Rather than simply falling open, the strong box seemed to bloom. The intricate filigree of the cube's four sides came unlocked and peeled outward onto the floor like the petals of a mechanical flower, revealing a simple mesh cage, and inside that cage...
My lexicon fails me, Crane said. Gilchrist?
Gilchrist only shook his head.
Fucking beauty, isn't it? Marin said. I peeked earlier.
Her mouth twisted.
I can see why you went to the trouble.
The crown was a heavy ring of unblemished gold that turned fiery in the lamplight, veined with new silver and set with gemstones the color of a sparkling clear sea.
The Thule clan's last link to the ancient kings, Crane murmured.
Far older than the elected Dogs. Older than Colgrid or even Brask. He yanked a work glove over his hand and removed the crown gently, so gently as if it might shatter under his fingers. Gilchrist's eyes were fixed to it as it revolved gleaming in the light.
Miraculous, Crane said. To be in such condition, after so many years.
His gaze hardened as he looked up.
You realize we have no compulsion to stay now that you've solved our toy for us. We could leave you and Riker to the fates.
I realize, yeah.
Merrin managed half a smile.
But I figured you would want to see it through, just to see how it all ends.
She looked from the crown to the splayed-open strongbox.
And if things go to shit tonight, I wanted to make sure I'd held up my end of the bargain.
News of the factory break-in diffused through Colgrid over the course of the day. Gilchrist and Crane heard snatches of it both times they left the concealment of the shop to buy twine, resin, gunpowder. They never removed their filter masks, and they took circuitous routes back to Marin's to ensure they weren't followed. By the time night fell, a stiff wind was building in the streets, enough to shift part of the smog. It flapped at their clothes as they made their way to the corner of the Four Angels. Gilchrist circled the block to ensure none of Riker's men were lying in wait. Then the three of them stepped into the sculpture's shadow. They were angels in the style of Brask, harsh and inhuman, with geometric faces, archaic script carved into their spindly limbs and spread wings. In the gusting wind, they seemed ready to take flight. Merrin climbed up to spread the resin in the crook of a stone elbow. Crane paced out the distance. It wasn't long before the tap, tap, tap of a strutter echoed up the cobblestone. They took their positions. Crane stood loose and insolent. Gilchrist and Merrin spread their feet and clasped their hands behind their backs, a military stance to keep Riker guessing. Gilchrist was massaging his hands in slow patterns, keeping his fingers warm and ready, but Merrin's were clenched white. A silhouette hulked through the gloom. Then Riker strode into view, a phosphor lantern clutched in his massive hand like a ball of witch's fire, illuminating the shark-like teeth of his filter mask. The strutter's driver followed him like a shadow, dressed in a long black jacket with the shape of a musket bulging underneath.
Mr. Riker, Crane greeted. You've failed to follow instructions. Do you not recall the consequences?
Riker halted 5 steps away from them, a gap that his long arms could close in an instant, and planted his feet. The tips of his boots were sharp and pointed toward them like knives. He surveyed them in silence through the lenses of his mask, then passed the lantern backward to his driver.
Nobody burns 3 barrels of the pure shit, he said. Not even a lunatic.
You seem quite convinced of their value, Crane said.
And yet they were so poorly secured. Removing them was child's play, frankly. You think it was clever?
Even through the mask, Riker's thin voice was taut with anger.
Using the children.
Clearly you think the same.
Everyone in Colgrid knows better than to steal from me, Riker said. That means you're not from here. Means you don't know winter. If those children stay on the street, they'll all be frozen fucking corpses in a couple months.
You keep them chained, Gilchrist said, speaking for the first time.
At night? Better that than have another one climb into a boiler.
Riker tapped a gnarled finger against his ornate mask.
Half the little shits are addled in the head right out of the womb, from their mothers breathing the smog. They won't last outside.
They left, Gilchrist said. First chance they had.
You didn't do them a fucking favor,
Riker snapped.
I feed them. I keep them off the shiver. Out of the whorehouses. The ones with any sense will come back to the factory. The others will freeze.
Crane cleared his throat. We digress, he said. Fortunately for you, Mr. Riker, the shiver we stole was not our primary target. Our reconnaissance was flawed, you see. He paused. We were told there might be Iker. Riker didn't react. We are opportunists, of course, so we took what we found, Crane continued. But as you ascertained, we are not from Colgrid. Our buyers lie farther south and receive shiver through more established channels. They want Iker for the fighting pits in Vera and Linza. That was what we intended to steal. Now we are open to an exchange.
You'd trade my own shit back to me?
Through the mask, Riker's laugh was a dead thing.
You do have some fucking balls on you.
Crane managed a careless shrug. Assuming you do have Iker, and that you've tested it. Riker regarded them for a long minute through his lenses.
How do you get the barrels out?
With considerable difficulty, Crane said. The method is irrelevant. Another long pause, then Riker spoke.
I have Iker. As a curiosity. There's not a market for it up here.
Marin twitched, reined it in. Riker didn't seem to notice. Then I propose a deal. Your shiver for your Iker. And if our buyers approve of your product, we might be able to establish a standing arrangement, lucrative for all parties. Crane's voice hardened. But we've encountered many would-be vendors returning from the New World, and their product is invariably a crude stimulant mixture that lacks the specific ferocity of true Iker. Riker cocked his head to the side for a moment.
It's real, he said. Gave it to a few mad beggars. One killed the other and fucked his corpse raw for an hour or so. I put him down as it wore off, more merciful than his having to remember it.
Marin was so still she might have been a statue herself. Crane drew a breath through his mask. How marvelous, he said. Though you would have been better served testing it on a more stable individual.
Those are hard to come by in Colgrid.
Riker waved a dismissive hand.
Half this fucking city is mad. But there was one other trial, yeah. When I first got my hands on the stuff, I cut some wastrel's shiver with it and sent him home to his woman.
The words drifted on the cold air. The angels seemed to bend forward, blank faces awaiting revelation. Did he know it was tainted? Crane asked softly. One must always be wary of the placebo response.
He didn't, Riker said. And when it came on, she shot him in the head. Clever cunt must have been waiting for an excuse to do that.
Marin ripped her filter mask down. The sudden motion triggered a flurry as the strutter driver drew her weapon, dropping the phosphor lantern. It smashed, painting a tableau in a burst of pale green. Crane had stepped back. Gilchrist's blade was out. The driver was aiming at Marin's chest. Riker peered at her. His flat laugh was contemptuous.
The clever cunt. The locksmith.
Marin had one hand still behind her back. The other trembled at her side as she spoke.
You know my fucking name?
I forgot it,
Riker said.
But I remember you needed a lesson.
Marin's face was twisted, half anger, half anguish.
You wanted me dead.
Riker looked at Crane and Gilchrist again, then back to Marin.
No,
he said coldly.
The beggars got a full dose. Your Petro got barely a trace. He would have fucked you good and hard, roughed you a bit, came to his senses and wondered where he'd gotten a spine all of a sudden.
Behind her back, Marin pulled the twine that wrapped around her fist and stretched like a spiderweb to the sculptures looming over them.
All you had to do was take your lesson, Riker said. Maybe you would have even liked it.
The crack of the concealed musket was deafening. Riker sank. Gilchrist lunged over him. A second crack, splitting the night air and sending shards of stone flying from an angel's ruined face. Gilchrist drove his quick knife through the driver's arm, and the smoking musket spun away in the dark. Then Riker was on his feet again, despite a ragged hole punched through his thigh, and his silence was more terrifying than anything else as he hurtled at Marin. Crane leapt from the side, but Riker swatted him away. Marin was backpedaling as Riker's fist glanced her jaw, snapping her head back. She crumpled to the cobblestone. Gilchrist was tangled with the driver, who was keening and bleeding as she scrabbled for the dropped gun. Riker swung at Marin again, enough force behind it to shatter her face, and Marin slid a metal shell from under her coat and thrust it up like a shield. Riker's hand caught in the mechanism. He made to pull back, and,
"Don't fucking move,"
Marin said, thick through a syrup of blood,
"or you'll lose it. Feel the spikes?"
Riker didn't move. Marin got slowly to her feet, still holding her end of the skull crusher. Crane picked himself up. Gilchrist joined them, delivering a last kick to the strutter driver. He had the musket in hand, first wiping blood off the grip with the edge of his shirt, then loading the second ball.
"You can have the fucking shiver,"
Riker said, not taking his eyes off his trapped hand.
"And I'll get you the Ichor, too. For your southern buyers."
"Oh, we have our sights set on far more exotic locales than Vera and Linza," Crane said, mildly apologetic. "We are bound for the New World once more, you see. Funded by a certain object worth more than all the ichor you could supply." He massaged his chest where Riker's blow had landed. "As for the shiver, it's currently piled in the bottom of your factory's third smokestack." Gilchrist placed the loaded musket in Marin's free hand. He hesitated.
"Do what you want," he said. "But remember, there's always a worse man."
"Our ship awaits us," Crane said. "We bid you farewell, Madam Marin. Mr. Riker, the hospitality of your fair city was very..." He trailed off, wrapping his coat more tightly around himself.
"You ever need another dead box opened?" Marin said vaguely.
She held the musket trained on Riker's forehead. Her hand was perfectly steady. Gilchrist pried the other musket from its hiding place and disassembled it with three smooth motions. Then he and Crane departed, plunging back into the winding streets, retrieving their things from a particular alley before heading toward the docks. Both of them listening for the sound of a final gunshot. The strong box sat between them on the rail, shifting precariously as the ship began to move. The crown's gemstones had been hidden in various boots, pockets, and pouches, while the crown itself resided inside Crane's wide-brimmed hat. Now the box was empty and stuck halfway open, a bat unsure of whether to unfurl its wings.
"Think she did him?" Gilchrist asked.
Crane cocked his head to the side, contemplating.
"I heard no third report," he said. "Though it's possible she marched him to a more secluded location first."
Gilchrist was silent for a moment.
"Scatty's tattoo, that was from the factory. But she had older marks on her too. Scars. From her mother, she said."
He grimaced.
"Maybe Riker was right about the children, and I only freed them to freeze to death. Maybe in the end, I'm worse than he was."
"We are all composed of light and darkness, Gilchrist," Crane said, "which in turn renders us all the same muddled gray as we stumble toward our respective graves.
Better not to meditate long on such matters."
He retrieved the bag of shiver he'd scooped from the top of Riker's barrel and tapped a fat white trail onto the back of his hand.
"The design of this box is remarkable. I imagine we could resell it."
Gilchrist shook his head.
"Not worth finding a fence. We're rich enough as is."
"Indeed." Crane snorted, rubbed his nose.
"It's time we started making arrangements for our passage across the ocean. The New World awaits our return. The infamous Crane and Gilchrist seeking further fortunes, battling the fates."
Gilchrist said nothing. Then he reached forward and pushed the strongbox off the edge of the rail. The winds caught its delicate mechanisms, winching it fully open, and it settled on the dark, slushy water like a metal flower. Crane fell into uneasy silence, stroking his bruised collarbone, as they watched it sink.
Elizabeth Bear. Here is a daring raid on a cursed, monster-haunted island by as odd and mismatched a trio of treasure hunters as ever rowed themselves hopefully ashore, only to find that they have no idea at all what they're getting themselves into. If they had, they might have rowed back again just as quickly. Elizabeth Bear was born in Connecticut and now lives in South Hadley, Massachusetts. She won the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer in 2005, and in 2008 took home a Hugo Award for her short story Tideline, which also won her the Theodore Sturgeon Memorial Award, shared with David Moles. In 2009, she won another Hugo Award for her novelette Shoggoths in Bloom. Her short work has appeared in Asimov's Science Fiction, Subterranean, Sci-Fiction, Interzone, The Third Alternative, Strange Horizons, On Spec, and elsewhere, and has been collected in The Chains That You Refuse and Shoggoths in Bloom. She is the author of the 5-volume New Amsterdam fantasy series, the 3-volume Jenny Casey science fiction series, the 5-volume Promethean Age series, the 3-volume Jacob's Ladder series, the 3-volume Edda of Burdens series, and the 3-volume Eternal Sky series, as well as 3 novels in collaboration with Sarah Monette. Her other books include the novels Carnival and Undertow. Her most recent book is an acclaimed novel, Karen Memory.
The King's Evil, Elizabeth Bear. I am a servant of King Pale Empire, Dr. Lady Lizzie muttered to herself, saltwater stinging her lips. My life at his command. Brave words. They did not quiet the churning inside her, but her discomfort did not matter. Only the brave words mattered, and her will to see them through. Lizzie told herself it was enough that this will would see her through to the treasures she sought, and further yet. She held a long, oiled silk package high and dry as she turned back in the warm surf to watch the metal man heave himself, streaming, from the aquamarine waters of the lagoon. He slogged up the slope beneath breakers rendered gentle by the curving arms of land beyond. The metal man, his kind were a sort of wizard servant common in the far west called a gauge, had a mirrored carapace that glittered between his tattered homespun rags like the surface of the water, blindingly. Behind him, a veiled man in a long red woolen jacket held a scimitar, a pistol, and a powder horn aloft as he sloshed awkwardly through the sea, waves tugging at the skirts of his coat. He was a dead man, a member of an elite and disbanded military sect from the distant and exotic west. Right now, ill-clad for the heat and the ocean, he looked ridiculous. Afloat on the deeper water, the auspicious voyage unfurled her bright patchwork wings and heeled her green hull into a slow turn. The plucky little vessel slid toward the gap where the lagoon's arms did not quite complete their embrace of the harbor. She took with her 3 hands, a ship's cat, and the landing party's immediate chance of escape from this reputedly cursed island. Even royal orders would not entice the captain to keep her in this harbor while awaiting the return of Lizzie and her party. They could signal with a fire in the morning if they were successful, and if not, well, at least it was a pretty place to die and a useful cause for dying in. Birds wheeled and flickered overhead. A heavy throb briefly filled the air, an almost mechanical baritone drone. A black fin sliced the water like a razor, then was gone. Lizzie sighed to herself and wondered if she had made a terrible mistake. True, her feet were on the sand, and she hadn't been afflicted with Isolation Island's purported royal death curse yet, but there was water yet foaming around her thighs. Maybe the eaten alive by maggots part wouldn't kick in until she was properly beached. Or maybe the blessing of her royal mission was enough to protect her, and maybe even the mercenaries, too. She had only hope and the store of sorcery promised by her honorific. Determination chilled in her belly. She turned her back on the sea and the splashing mercenaries and marched through the water to the dark gray beach, so different from the pink coral sand of most of the Banner Isles. Each roll of the sea sucked sand from under her as if the waves themselves warned her away. She forced herself not to hesitate as she stepped from the surf. Waiting wouldn't alter anything. When the solid, wet sand compacted under her bare toes, though, she still held her breath. And didn't die. Didn't sense the gathering magic of a triggered hex either, which was a good sign. She paused just above the tide line and turned back. While she waited for the mercenaries, she unwrapped her long knife and wrapped the silk around her waist as a sash, then stuck the knife in its scabbard through the sash, where she could reach it easily. By the time she was done, the dead man had also gained the beach. The gauge was still heaving himself forward, step by sucking step, his great weight a tremendous handicap. Lizzie threw back her head and laughed. Well, here I am, foot upon the sand, and no sign of warbles yet, you cowards. Whether the retreating sailors heard her or not, she could not tell. The only one she could spot on deck was second mate, and he seemed busy with the sail.
This was a terrible idea,
the dead man said as he found his stability in the sandy bottom. Water pumped from the top of his boots with every stride. He didn't dignify their marooners with a backwards glance. Lizzie supposed from the stiffness of his shoulders that the stiffness of his neck was quite intentional.
At least you'll dry out fast in the heat,
the gauge said, conversationally.
Crusted in such salt as will rub one raw in every crevice.
You should strip down, said Lizzie. I don't know how you stand it. She wrung out her own bright gauze skirt between her hands. The dead man ignored her and thrust his sword through the sash, binding his coat closed.
I'll be crusted in salt too, very shortly,
the gauge said. Lizzie wondered if it would flake and freckle off his metal hide. He didn't seem to have corroded yet. He pointed with a glittering hand to the dark blue water the auspicious voyage was already slicing through.
How does a coral atoll form in such deep water?
The dead man swept a hand around.
Ah, my friend, you see, this island is unlike the others. It is volcanic. The black sand reveals its nature. That's not a coral ring, it's the caldera.
You aren't as ill-educated as you look, Lizzie said. She kept her face neutral, hoping the mercenaries would know she meant to include herself in their bantering. That's the reason the king from this island chose the name King Fire Mountain Dynasty.
Is it extinct?
The gauge asked. Lizzie shook out her orange-patterned wrapped skirt so it would dry in the breeze. It hasn't erupted since about 1600, I think. The gauge paused. She supposed he was doing a date conversion to his weird Western system of dating by years after the frost, and came up with what Lizzie hoped was a comforting thousand-year cushion.
That could just mean that it's biding its time. I've heard volcanoes are so wont.
The dead man tugged his veil more evenly across his face. According to the books, such soldiers revealed their faces only when they were about to kill.
Do you not care to discover if your magical, impervious hide is magically impervious to molten stone, my brother? Oh,
said the gauge,
I think I'll pass on being smelted.
Anyway, Lizzie interrupted, pretending to be impervious to the smirk showing at the corners of the dead man's eyes. There's plenty of fresh water on the island for you to rinse yourself in. There's a stream right there. A braid of clear water trickled over steel-colored sand. When she stepped toward it, Her bare feet left prints like pearls had been pressed into the wet, packed beach beside their parent oyster shells. The gauge called her attention to the answering marks on the far side of the freshwater rill at the same moment that she noticed them herself, and just an instant after the dead man invoked his prophet and her goddess. A furrow, as if a boat had been dragged up the beach to be hidden in the greenery, with the divots of striving feet beside it. Fresh.
"Isn't it a strange thing," the dead man said conversationally, "that we should not be the only visitors to such an out-of-the-way, shunned, supposed, cursed, and abandoned island on the very same day?"
Lizzie stopped, staring at the furrow. Strange indeed.
"I don't suppose there's any significance to this particular date on the calendar?"
After a day's acquaintance, Lizzie had already learned that the more casually curious the dead man sounded, the more likely he was to have his hand on his wheel lock. She checked. Yes, there it was, resting on the ornately elaborate pistol butt. She slapped at a mosquito that was insufficiently discouraged by the sea breeze and the brightness of the sun burning white in the rich blue sky. "Well," she said resignedly, "now that you mention it. But before we talk about that, I'm going to wash the salt off." The outrigger was inside the jungle's canopy, screened and shaded by ferns and vines. Lizzie and the gauge stood over it, touching nothing, counting the seats, estimating the provisions cached under canvas for when the paddlers returned. 4 seats, and they seemed to have all been filled, leaving not much room for spoils. Lizzie slapped another mosquito and bent down to peer. She found that what was under the canvas was not food, but blown glass fishing floats. Perhaps they, too, were here to steal the dead King Fire Mountain Dynasty's treasure, and they intended to float the treasure back? Or sink it and mark its location? But then anyone could come along and claim it. "So it's possible," Lizzie said, "and perhaps even likely that His Majesty King Pale Empire was overheard making preparations to rescind the old king's curse on his island, and perhaps they decided to try to beat us to the treasure. If this interloper should succeed, of course, it would be disastrous for the poor, as King Pale Empire means to use these resources to provide for the needy."
"That is a thing that still confounds my understanding. How is it that such treasure has come to be left in a tomb?"
"It's not a tomb," Lizzie said, for what felt like the 500th time. "It's a palace."
"A tomb," said the dead man patiently, "is perforce where a corpse is maintained."
"Look at the bright side,"
the gauge interrupted, coming back.
"We just got significantly less marooned.
You designed to steal their canoe and abandon them to the haunted island?"
The dead man slapped at a mosquito as well, less patiently.
"Well," the gauge said, "I'd still have to walk back. That won't carry me. But I was thinking that they could take a message to the auspicious voyage for us, if they turn out to be polite, and maybe they'd let you straddle the outrigger."
"Much to the amusement of the sharks,"
the dead man said, slapping.
"Dr. Lady Lizzie, you're a natural philosopher. Can't you do anything about these mosquitoes?"
"Welcome to the tropics,"
the gauge said lightly.
"Tell him about the parasites, Dr. Lady Lizzie."
Lizzie paused within the canopy and found long-leaved zodia plants. They had a pungent, fecund scent, and a handful of leaves stuffed into a pocket or waistband did a fairly good job of keeping the mosquitoes at bay. "The fact is," she said a few moments later, while holding a tangle of vines aside for the dead man, "having all this gold tied up in mausoleums is murder on the economy." Her knife was still sheathed in her sash. Whoever had come before them had done a good job cutting a path. While it was regrowing already, it would be useful for a few days more.
"So the current king wants to rob his ancestor's tomb to put a little cash back into the system."
It was hard to tell when the gauge was being sarcastic, unless he was always being sarcastic. He was a wicked and tireless hand with the machete, however. "Not so much rob the tomb as put the treasure back into circulation, to use as relief for the poor. And King Fire Mountain Dynasty was not King Pale Empire's ancestor, said Lizzie. Our kings are not hereditary, only their voices are, and that's because of magic. A retired king can only speak through his female relatives.
It would be less hassle if your kings all came from the same lineage,
the gauge suggested.
Then at least the money would still be in the family, and the new king could use it, instead of its all going to sustain a relic, and the current kings would keep siring voices for their ancestors.
Sure, said Lizzie. There are absolutely no problems with hereditary dynasties, and everybody wants to spend all eternity being bossed around personally by their ancestors. Smooth sailing all the way.
Well, said the gauge, would you put it like that?
The dead man looked at Lizzie shrewdly over his veil.
Will you be an interlocutor for the current king when he is gone?
Not gone exactly either, Lizzie said. The kings drink certain sacred potions which are derived by natural philosophers such as myself, abstain from most foods and many physical pleasures. If they have the discipline to stay the course, the flesh hardens and becomes incorruptible. The processes of life stop, but the life remains. They may continue for a long time in such a state, far beyond a mortal lifespan, but eventually the flesh hardens to the point where they cannot move or speak on their own. And then they need interlocutors, voices.
Interlocutors like you.
King Pale Empire has successfully attained the blessed state, she said, aware her voice was stiff. But he does not yet require a voice. Once he does, a new king will rule, and he will retire to the position of honored antecedent. In the meantime, I am merely his servant and a scientist. I am not of his blood, though in his kindness he adopted me into the royal family, and only women of the royal line may serve as voices to the ancestors.
How can you be sure the kings are actually saying anything through their voices that the voices did not think up themselves? It seems like one of the few ways a woman could get a little power around here.
Lizzie had wondered that herself on occasion. She chose to answer obliquely. There are stories of voices who did not do the will of their kings.
Let me guess, the gauge said. They all end in tragedy and fire.
Stacks of corpses, as must always the ambitions of women.
So, this old dead king is not dead, but has no living female descendants willing to serve as his interlocutors, the dead man said. He's a king with no voice. What we are embarked upon, well, sounds like robbery to me, begging your pardon.
Lizzie shrugged. Politics as usual. The voiceless are always powerless. The gauge said,
And is that the future you desire for yourself?
Lizzie opened her mouth to temporize and wasn't sure what it was about the gauge's eyeless gaze that paralyzed her voice inside her. Maybe it was simply the necessity of regarding her own face, stretched and strangely disordered, in the flawless mirror of his face. She shut her mouth, swallowed, and tried again, but what came out was the truth. I have no people beyond the king.
What became of the family of your birth?
The dead man asked, so formally she could not take offense. It was prying in the extreme, but the dead man was a foreigner and probably didn't know any better. My parents and brother were killed, Lizzie said, which was both the truth and devoid of useful information.
I'm sorry,
the dead man said. He paused to allow that heavy throbbing sound to rise and fade again, then added, as a small kindness,
I lost my family too.
Do you miss them? Lizzie asked, surprising herself with her own rudeness in turn. She had, at best, jumbled memories of her kinfolk. Warmth, a boy who teased her and took her sweets, but also comforted her when she fell and hurt herself. Two large figures with large calloused hands, sweet rice gruel served in a wooden bowl.
The first family I was too young to remember,
the dead man said without breaking stride. Nimbly, he leaped a branch.
The second family... Yes, I miss them very much.
Lizzie looked away, wondering how to get out of this one. The dead man's voice had been so matter of fact. The gauge sank up to the knees in the compost underfoot. Lizzie thought it was a good thing Brass didn't seem to feel tiredness the way bone and muscle did, or he'd have worn himself out just walking on anything except a paved road. The dead man, kindly, took the opportunity to change the subject.
It's amazing you ever get anywhere.
The dead man crouched on a long, low branch, his soft boots still leaving squelching footprints. The wetness of the soles did not seem to impede his footing.
I may not get there quickly,
the gauge replied, his voice as level as if he sat on cushions in a parlor.
But I have yet to fail to wind up where I intended, and when I pass through a place, few fail to remember where I have been.
Lizzie hid a shiver by shrugging her pack off her shoulder. She drank young coconut water. As she capped the canteen, she shrugged to herself. What else had she to spend her life on? More musty, if fascinating, research? More monographs that no one but other naturalists would ever even care about, much less read? More theory on the function of the body and deriving the essential principles from certain plants? More service to an ideal because she had no ambition of her own to work toward? Perversely, ironic fatalism made her feel a little less empty inside. If she had nothing of her own to live for, it was surely better to find a purpose in life in serving others rather than increasing suffering and chaos. If you were alone, wasn't it the choice of the superior woman to serve those who were not? The dead man shrugged. He stood up on his bow, pivoted on the balls of his feet, and ran lightly along the rubbery gray bark while the branch dipped and swayed under him until he reached a point where another limb crossed the first at mid-thigh. He stepped up onto the other without seeming to break stride and ran along it in turn toward some presumed trunk invisible through the foliage ahead. The sound of his footsteps faded into the jungle noise before he vanished from view. He had the sort of physique that grew veins instead of muscles, and it made his strength seem feral and weightless. In so many ways, the opposite of the gauge. And yet Lizzie could not shake the feeling that in every essential way, the two were identical, except that one wore his armor on the outside and the other beneath his skin. She did not desert the gauge. She couldn't have kept up with the dead man's branch running, and it seemed a poor idea to allow their little party to become strung out. She wasn't sure if the gauge noticed, because he labored along without comment. She was relieved, though, when the dead man dropped through the canopy above and ran down a broad bough, his tight-wrapped veil fluttering at the edges. He skidded sideways on his insteps until he was just a foot or two above eye level, far enough away that Lizzie didn't need to crane her head back to see him.
I found the tomb, he announced.
Palace, she corrected automatically. He shrugged.
It resembles a tomb to my eye.
Lizzie insisted they pause to eat before pushing any further into unknown dangers, which was easy in the rich lands of the Banner Islands. They had not even packed supplies. Lizzie and the dead man simply scanned the earth under the enormous canopy of a breadfruit tree to find ripe, scaly globes, pulled them open, and dined on the mild, custard-like innards. She expected complaints. Raw, fresh breadfruit was generally regarded as a bland staple at best, but the foreigner spread a linen cloth that was clean but no longer white across his lap and ate without comment, raising his veil with one hand while scooping morsels from the fruit with the other. Maybe there was no way to eat a ripe breadfruit daintily, but that did not stop him from trying. Lizzie wondered what exquisite manners looked like where he came from. Something like this, she imagined. The gauge didn't seem to care about food. The dead man finished and wiped his fingers daintily on the cloth. He was rolling the cloth so that the soiled portion would not smirch the clean when that searching drone rose once again. The dead man glanced around, cupping a hand behind his veil to better localize the sound. What is that? Dr. Lady Lizzie had a hypothesis, But she didn't like it very much, and anyway, she wasn't confident enough yet to advance it for discussion. One did not become a lady doctor by making assertions in public of which one was not confident, and which one could not back up with facts. Insects? She asked.
Well, no maggot curse yet,
the gauge said as lightly as a 7-foot-tall brazen bass could be expected to say anything. The dead man shook his jacket clean of non-existent crumbs.
Mayhap we've not yet gone far enough in.
Lizzie followed him through the forest. He stayed on the ground this time and paused at one point to show her 4 sets of footprints in a marshy place. They were fresh, filling with water but still sharp-edged. One set was smaller than the others. The gauge looked at the swampy bit and took the long way around. By the time he rejoined them, Lizzie and the dead man were already paused behind a screen of greenery, staring across a yard of crushed seashells toward a temple or a palace or, she had to admit, a mausoleum. The whole was constructed of pillars, pillars upon pillars upon pillars, stacked in tiers with black basalt in the middle, white coral at the center, and red coral at the top with intermediate shades between. So the effect, rather than stripes or bands, was as of the fade from black night to crimson sunrise, only in reverse. Lizzie had expected the palace to be overrun with verdancy, the pillars stumpy and jagged, but it was at least somewhat intact, and if not manicured, she could see where the long knives had recently been at work. Maybe King Fire Mountain Dynasty is still aware, she said. Someone is tending this place.
Not the people from the canoe?
The gauge asked. She shrugged. They probably had machetes. Something burst into the clearing from the jungle to their left without warning, with such speed and force that Lizzie stifled a cry of surprise. It was high up, oil iridescent, as big and darkly barbed as a bluefin tuna, and as sleekly shaped for speed. A blur of glistening wings surrounded it, and Lizzie had a confused momentary perception of faceted sapphires glittering as big as her 2 fists before she realized they were eyes.